Johnny Depp's life gets burned, Jesse Pinkman's desire for velocity, and get on the list, Schindler's List, this week on 302010.
God damn it, Chris.
Every show, sometimes associated videos. 302010, surprises and excitement. Yes, we're going to the 90s and 2000s and 2010s. On 302010.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to 302010, the LaserTime Network's weekly pop culture time machine, telling you all about the cool movie, TV, music, video game, anniversary celebrations, milestones, things that happened 30, 20, and 10 years ago in our pop culture collective past. And you guessed it, people, this week it's time to talk about Schindler's List! Yeah! I swear it's going to be a fun episode, but there's a really important movie we got to talk about. Among others, I cannot believe what released up against Schindler's List. There is plenty to talk about this episode, including everyone's favorite Aaron Paul movie based on a video game. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Santista. Who else is with me?
I'm Diana Goodman, and I have a face only a mother could love on payday. and I still have my Pulitzer on it.
You do a pretty good Jennifer Jason Leigh.
I'm J.R. Rawls, and I tried, listeners. I tried to get Diana to do the entire podcast as a wisecracking, fast-talking 1950s newspaper reporter. It didn't happen.
She probably hangs out with a guy like named Sammy. Smitty. Yeah.
And it takes eight balls all day.
Obviously, yes. His name is Smitty.
Smitty. Oh, love that movie. There's so much fun stuff to talk about.
I will talk like a Howard Hawks dame all day. You can't stop me. Except it's really inappropriate for this episode, so I'm not going to do it.
Thank you so much for joining us, everyone. I really... Why did it take this long to stumble upon a good, really great Diana impression? That's really good. Thank you once again to our patrons, patreon.com/lasertime. Lots of talk about A's in depth. I really hope we're going to do the one that's being talked about right now because it's just one of my absolute favorites. So many fun things to talk about in this episode. Yeah, a really weird rediscovery for me I wanted to talk about real quick because I think I'm going to make a crazy decision, life decision based on it. Tune in for that. All right, where do we start? 30, 20, and 10 years ago, we discuss all the stuff that came out, mild news. It helps you remember where you were and what you were doing in these exact periods. It really does for me anyway. It was 30, 20, 10 years ago, we begin as we always do in 1994. 30 years ago, March 8th to the 14th, that is our window, 3 weeks across three decades. A little bit of news to bring you into the wonderful world of 30 years ago. The U.S. Defense Department announces a smoking ban in workplaces.
It's, how can you work in a submarine if you're not allowed to smoke there?
It's... I grew up with entertainment filled with smoking, but the ubiquity of indoor cigarettes is very early in my age. The mall in my hometown that's still miraculously open, its limbs are slowly dying as Sears and Macy's rot off, but it's an open-air two-story thing. There were troughs the entirety of the walkway meant for cigarettes. I can't think of any habit or vice that was so catered to than cigarettes. And I did want to ask you,
because it's so addicting, first of all, and so much of it, you know, most people who drink don't take a drink every 30 minutes.
Don't have 20 beers a day.
Yeah.
There was a time where 40% of Americans smoked.
Wow. All those doctors were recommending it.
I know.
And I did want to ask you guys, given our ages, unless you worked in a bar or restaurant, do you ever remember anyone smoking indoors somewhere you worked? Because I definitely don't.
Ooh. I do. My very first job was I was a lot attendant at a car dealership, and salesmen smoked like a chimney.
No shit. Like in where they're selling vehicles?
Mm-hmm. I mean, not in the vehicle you're driving, but like in between selling.
I know, but when you're trying to pass people in a hard sell, you know, like you, I'm assuming you want to hyper pleasant, adaptable environment to everyone, perhaps not the lingering tar of flavor country.
Yeah. I mean, car salesmen spend enough time outside, you'd think they would just go outside for their smoke break. But
They did. That's what pissed me off. My job, about half of it, was every day I had to walk around the entire car lot picking up cigarette butts. Wow. And that made me hate smokers with a passion for the rest of my life. Because really, the first 4 hours of my day was just walking around this giant-ass car lot, cigarette butt, cigarette butt, cigarette butt.
Yeah, and the first time I got in trouble regarding cigarettes, I don't know what provoked me and my friend Ryan in elementary school. We weren't smoking. We were picking up cigarette butts underneath the bleachers, pretending to smoke them. Like, wow, I kind of get it. Me too. We're so adult. And we got caught in minor trouble. But the amount of cigarette butts underneath an elementary school baseball bleachers is what thoroughly astounds me now. How many people were smoking around their children? It was so much.
40%.
40%. It was a lot of cigarette butts. They didn't walk off to the side. They just smoked in their younger children's face. It's incredible. Anyway, smoking, I'd love to hear, maybe that'll create a discourse in some of the Laser Time discussion groups, because smoking bans are a slow rollout depending on where you are. And where, you know, in California, it was like, you can't smoke within 75 feet of this building, let alone inside of one. Anyway.
Yeah, I remember when you could. I remember I went to the movie theater and you were allowed to smoke in the lobby, but not in the theater. And so the ashtrays were always just, because every cigarette was like half a cigarette, because people would get like a little fit and then they put it out. And so you would always see the ashtrays at the movie theater would just be like a porcupine. And you're like,
So that must be when you're real young in California then.
Probably pretty close to around this time, actually. It's around when they really started the bans.
Smoking. Oh, my God. Smoking in movie. I do remember that. We had a theater called Mugs and Movies. When I would run away from home, it was the closest movie theater at half a mile away. And it didn't have aisles as much as it had little Merv Griffin sets. Swivel chairs surrounding a small table because it was a full bar. And everyone just smoked at the screen. Incredible to think about. And I miss it so much. Sorry. Smoking. I don't actually miss it. Fuck smoking. Try and quit if you can.
But I don't remember the late night jokes about this, but I can imagine people saying like, well, now we're going to get in a nuclear war because everyone in the Pentagon is going to be all pissed off because they can't smoke and pace and want to blow people up.
Yeah. And meanwhile, it's been forever since I've seen a politician holding a cigarette. They had to sneak those Obama pictures.
Yeah. Now I'm wondering who is the most powerful politician who openly smokes.
I can't imagine. It's got to be Joe Manchin. He lives on a yacht. He doesn't care what people think of him. He doesn't vote in accordance with anybody. I'm betting he's a secret smoker. Well, we're going to begin with our discussion of movies of 1994, March 8th through the 14th. This definitely helps me remember where I was, because I was taken to see this movie, as I think good parents should have done. I'm glad they did that.
Yep. And I want to make clear, we're talking about Schindler's List. It came out at the beginning of December, and it was a very slow rollout. It was 100 theaters, then it was like 200, then it was 400, then it was 800. This is its widest release, and that's because next week is the Oscars, and it has been nominated for fucking everything. This is the perfect time. They've built the word of mouth, built all the critics awards and everything. And so now this is like, okay, now everyone can finally see this movie.
Yeah, I know I lived in a small town, but I definitely saw it before the Oscars, because there weren't, up until like Forrest Gump, there weren't that many movies I'd seen before they win an Oscar. So I definitely remember that aspect. See what I'm saying about 30-20-10? But first up, we're going to talk about the big one. And Beth Davids, Ben Kingsley, Ralph Fiennes, and Liam Neeson in Schindler's List.
There were names. Names that stood for evil, for madness, for terror. But there were also names that brought hope, that meant courage. Names like Oskar Schindler. Their lives meant nothing until their names meant everything to him. A film by Steven Spielberg, Schindler's List, rated R.
Schindler's List, and I'm trying to keep a pleasant attitude because I think I'm going to compare this movie a lot to 12 Years a Slave, even though that compare, there's on the surface no real comparison there. It's just in our 30-20-10 viewing experiences. Movies we saw, thought were beautiful, but were too hard to rewatch, and dealing in important films dealing with subject matter that take home Best Picture Academy Awards. But other than, like, I was dreading it like that because of how difficult 12 and how mad 12 Years a Slave made me. But I've seen Schindler's List a lot. The double VHS tape was kind of ubiquitous after its Oscar win, and I found this much more palatable to watch as a movie. I got upset. I made sure to, here's what I tried to do. I'm going to drink. And if I'm going to get sad, I'm going to get like ugly cry sad, and that's okay. And then I'm going to watch Disney's Wish and watch it all for the first time and watch it all the way.
I think the big difference, Chris, is that Schindler's List is a story of a man going through a heroic journey.
There is
12 Years a Slave is just a guy trying to survive a horrible situation. This is Schindler's story. We are seeing most of this film, a lot of it through his eyes. We're seeing him grow as a person. We're seeing him start to have more empathy as a person. We're start to see him change from being a guy who just wants to make money to one at the very end who was desperate to save every life he could. And that is an incredible journey to go through.
Yeah.
In a way that he's getting better through his eyes, through his personal journeys. Whereas the slave in 12 Years a Slave wasn't a better person at the end of that experience.
Yeah.
He was just surviving.
Yeah, doing whatever and because the more obvious thing, like as a white American, I'm not indirectly involved with what happened in the Holocaust. I didn't have anything to do with that. My family didn't have anything to do with that. And I don't benefit from any of it. I don't have the same cultural baggage I do with slavery as I do with the Holocaust, other than
right. That's
and
one thing.
That's why Hollywood's made so many more Holocaust films than it has slavery.
Well, I mean, there's a couple reasons. Well, yeah, I would like to see more slavery movies. Is really what the problem there is. Mm. So I wanted to ask you guys, when did you learn about the Holocaust? Because I feel like this is one of those. I feel like this is a lot of people's kind of introduction to it. And then I was trying to think back as a Jew, when did I first learn? I'm like, I have no idea. It's always been there. At least when I was five, I already knew about the Holocaust.
I have to imagine when you were a little kid, especially your older relatives, probably offhandedly mentioned it enough to where you slowly put together a picture in your head. Because I think I've said it before, I was not a history fan as a student. And I don't remember ever learning about the Holocaust. I did want to make one addendum, because I've said repeatedly, I didn't hear about the Holocaust till Schindler's List. I said that this weekend, and like, I think my sister was like, we went and saw The Diary of Anne Frank, and you loved it, when you were like 12. And like, that's true. And I think Buster Bluth or Cheryl Hines was in it. I did see that at Tallahassee's Young Actors Theater, where they were both a part of. I do remember that's when it had to be explained to me, but I'm like 11. So it's just, that's just another thing in history that happened, not the apex of horror that we kind of associate it with now. It wasn't properly taught to me in school. And I remember when I was 14, when this movie came out, the next year they aired it on TV with like super limited commercial interruptions and no cuts. And my class, and we got to the section in our history books where the Holocaust happened. The teacher shut his mouth and put on Schindler's List, and we didn't discuss it. That's what happened that year in history. In some college classes, I think we went into some greater depth, but like, in my opinion, not taught very well in American schools.
No.
I was a big history guy at this point, so I had already learned about the Holocaust. I think I probably learned about it whenever I learned about World War II. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, those that are pretty intertwined. And for my own kids, kind of really explained it to them during quarantine, because we did watch Diary of Anne Frank, just because we're all trapped together. Here's a film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I tried to give them the historical context behind it.
Interesting. So it was really hard to come up with a direction of how to talk about this movie, because I feel like people treat it like this, like it's a untouchable holy object. And I really wanted to like watch it as a movie and figure out why it works as a movie. And I found it really, really interesting. I mean, Spielberg made some incredibly smart choices. First of all, directing this movie, he was going to do Cape Fear.
Yeah.
And Scorsese was going to do this movie.
They swapped.
They did swapsies.
Do you know who I am so incredibly grateful we did not get to direct this movie?
Who?
Because it was a close run thing.
Yeah.
Roman Polanski was almost going to direct Schindler's List. And I am so glad that we don't have to have his name in discussion with the Holocaust, because he actually lived in a ghetto.
Excuse me. Yeah. The Pianist. We talked about the
Pianist.
I know.
JR. You love The Pianist.
You're right. I did. But
That's not a Holocaust movie. That has a bit of Holocaust in it.
Well, I guess it's a Holocaust movie in the same way Diary of Anne Frank is. Mm. It's about someone trying to avoid it. But we see the clearing of the ghetto. We see the ghetto uprising.
You're right. But to me, Schindler's List is the apex of Holocaust films. It's the one that gets discussed the most. It's the one that I think kind of changed. There'd been Holocaust movies before it, but I think this was the one that allowed it to be more graphic and realistic than we'd seen in the past.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the one thing trying to figure out, like, yeah, why is this held up as being like the ultimate Holocaust movie? Besides the fact that, you know, it's made by a filmmaker at the height of their powers. They're taking it personally. Spielberg's doing different things he's never done before. He always storyboarded everything. Mm-hmm. And this one, he's like, nah, gonna wing it. Here, give me the camera. I'll do some handheld stuff. Whatever.
Oh, you got to compare this film to Jurassic Park, which was filmed at almost the exact same time. Jurassic Park, almost every shot's a dolly shot. Almost every shot is this sweeping, epic thing. This is so much handheld. It's just night and day. And it's amazing to me that he filmed those pretty much back to back. What an emotional whiplash, which he's on the record of saying, you know, he was filming this, seeing cuts of Jurassic Park and was like, I don't give a fuck about these dinosaurs when I'm trying to do this film.
Well, I think he said post-production of realistic dinosaurs was a boon to my attitude when having to stage Auschwitz sequences, and like I can at least go home and look at the prettiest dinosaurs that ever happened.
something different to think about.
And that's the best anecdote is that Sid Sheinberg, the Universal head, bought the rights to this the decade before it was shot, and it couldn't get Steven Spielberg to do it. And then Spielberg rightfully was like, I don't know that I'm ready to tackle that. And he you got to do Jurassic Park first now that you finally decided to make Schindler's List. Why?
Well,
you just have to. He's like, cause he knew he is not going to be the same filmmaker after making. It's not just my age. That is sort of the end of Spielberg as Captain Popcorn, this movie.
This is the dividing line in his career. There is definitely a pre-Schindler's List Spielberg and a post-Schindler's List Spielberg. But he had to build up to that, as he says in this quote.
Before I ever made the two personal movies that allowed me to make Schindler's List, the first was Color Purple, and the second was Empire of the Sun. And those, for me, were the stepping stones that gave me the courage to take on a story of the Shoah.
It's incredible to think about, because as inarguably the most prominent Jewish filmmaker, I have to imagine he is constantly, Steven, when are you going to make a movie about our story, put our story on film? And I think he got that a lot. And he's just like, don't put that on me. I can't tell that story. And it took him a while to get the confidence to do that. I don't think I would have the confidence to tell the most important story of my culture.
Well, I would be constantly worried about leaving things out. Mm-hmm. And he did. And they did. There's some things that are just like, he was like, it's so horrible to film some of these things that were just, people aren't going to react to them well. And there's been a lot of criticism. Most of the criticism of Schindler's List is that it doesn't center Jewish characters. Mm-hmm. This is it's a story about the good German. Mm-hmm. And the Jewish characters are basically accessories. And his story is the one that's being told. And that's fair. There are a trillion stories from this time. And there's always different ways to come at them. But I appreciate I think that's a completely fair argument. But also sort of like, well, who are we reaching? Like I said, I don't need to be told the Holocaust is terrible. I'm a Jew. But you don't need to preach to that choir. But on the other hand, what if 12 Years a Slave was told from someone else's point of
Michael
view?
Michael Fassbender's perspective.
Well, why is it Michael Fassbender's story about trying to get this guy to work, but he's being so uppity all the time, and he's stealing paper and trying to write to people? Oh, it's so frustrating.
I think it's rather brilliant, because this is Oscar Schindler's a real guy, but he's closer to the atrocities we associate with the Holocaust than most civilians ever would be. Because, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong here, JR, it wasn't common knowledge to most Germans that any of this was even happening to this degree.
I mean, it depends. That's a really big question, Chris, because there were these things called Einsatzgruppen, which were just average German soldiers who went around killing every Jew. Mm-hmm. They would tell their families what they did. It wasn't publicized in newspapers or anything, but it was an acknowledged thing. Mm. If you were following the war, you know that the Jews were going
away and not coming back. Well, I mean, either way,
going away forever, and that's why I get to represent or suggest Zone of Interest as being a movie from just now, just this year, that's up for the Oscars that Spielberg said is probably the best Holocaust movie he's seen since Schindler, because it is about people who are literally living next to Auschwitz, who it's their job is to do this shit, and they have perfectly normal lives. They can just compartmentalize, and that's fine. It's over there. Yes, there's constant trains coming in and out. Yes, there is ash falling from the sky day and night, but look at my garden. Well, I'm gardening, everybody.
That's why Oscar Schindler, I think, is a great character for us to see this through, because he is inside and out of these things, because he is... I tried to read a little more about him as a person, but it seems like he didn't like the Germans. And he basically takes this attitude as a war profiteer. If I can exploit the Jews as slave labor, I can make a shitload of money off of this war effort that I desperately hope that's a great, irredeemable character to get a redemption story out of. That was his attitude. Like, so he's both in and out of he has free reign to walk in and out of these camps because it's his job, and he's a highfalutin character in German society.
Yep. Well, I think this the thing that rewatching this made me understand. Like, yeah, why is this sort of the Holocaust movie? Because it walked through all of the stages of the Holocaust. Yeah. It didn't go from 0 to 60. It goes in stages. They leave out the first part, which is let's blame the Jews for all of our problems. And then let's take away all their civil rights. You can't work in a job. You're not actually a citizen anymore. You don't have any rights. And it starts with, they got to go to the ghetto. We're going to take all these people. We're going to shove them in a tiny little area. Then we get the clearing of the ghetto, which is sheer brutality, to the work camp, to the death camp. We get all of those stages. And I totally forgot, the first death in this movie comes 40 minutes in. And it is the step that's missing in this narrative, very quickly snuck in there. The euthanasia program is actually where the Holocaust starts. It starts with, let's get rid of defectives, which could be people with Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, people who have seizures. Oh, no. Yes, let's get rid of all the people that are disabled. The first guy who gets killed is the guy with one arm.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we almost sort of quietly get a reference to the euthanasia program. And then we got to go through the slave labor and then the death camp at the end. That's another complaint people often had, is the fact that it's almost like a bad joke when they all get herded into what we think is a gas chamber. And it turns out it actually is a shower.
See, it's I didn't feel that was harrowing. A joke. I thought that was like heart clenching more than anything else. And it makes you for 1 second experience 1,000th of the fear they were experiencing.
Yeah. So that's the thing that makes this different from so many other Holocaust movies. And yeah, there are plenty in their stories of the good Germans who helped, and there's stories of people who survived and people who didn't survive. And yeah, so we get the whole understanding of why is this happening? Well, we hate these people and we like slave labor.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's this like,
work them to death.
Such a brutal scene when there's this little girl just shouting at the trains, goodbye, Jews, goodbye, Jews.
That was the original title.
So much.
Sorry. I told you I was going to try and keep it light.
So much hate in that little girl's voice.
Yeah.
Yep.
And yeah, I mean, it's Spielberg showing what an amazing director he is, making that choice, making the little girl in red, which is based on Schindler's memory. He remembers this one girl and she just stood out in his memory when a bunch of others got forgotten. And so to have one character in this film be in color with a red coat is just brilliant.
And I love the acknowledgement of like, oh, I have access to color. You don't get that because I need to tell you the story.
No, I agree that it would. There was a lot of talk of shooting it in black and white versus color. And could we put out a color VHS? It's like, I mean, first of all, the cinematography is outstanding. This is the first time Spielberg works with Janusz Kaminski, and he has not worked with a single other cinematographer since. They clicked so fucking hard on this movie. 30 years of Spielberg movies, all kinds of different movies. Yeah, always Janusz Kaminski.
It was a little fascinating, and I don't have the language to really express this, to watch Nebraska, a movie intentionally cinematographized for black and white with digital technology, and how different they look. Like, they look very, very different. There are effects you can't recreate with digital film that happen at arguably the apex of analog film in 1994. Mm-hmm. It's really pretty to look at.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, the black and white stylizes it. It puts it in a different time period. And then when it does go to color at the end, when we're in modern times, it's sort of like, oh, we've moved forward into the present now. I understand. Mm-hmm. You know, it feels like kind of a relief when we're in the present. We're like, oh, okay. All right, yeah. We're done.
That scene at the end was shot at the last minute. They weren't sure they were going to go that way, and they had to like try to round up all the survivors like super quick. But it is so powerful mm-hmm. and so moving. I'm really glad they kept it in.
Yeah, it was a deliberate move to make the most significant American Holocaust film that's ever existed, and got to check every box. And that was the last box. Like. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you can make a more significant film. You can tell maybe a more harrowing story, but like I tried to frame, my construct of the Holocaust is built with Schindler's List. And it's on more atrocious.
I was amazed by that. So I haven't seen this film in 30 years. I think it's one of the best films ever made. And yet I haven't watched it since it came out in theaters.
I have.
This week with my children.
Wow.
And then it's probably going to be, so listeners, my kids are half Jewish. So, you know, I try to make sure they have exposure to that side of their heritage. And
so you were going to do this regardless of the show. Just promise me that.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't want to wish that on them.
My son was 11, and I thought he was old enough now to watch it. If I didn't, I wouldn't have shown it to him. But, you know, maybe it went a little early.
I wasn't. I wasn't really able to rent rated R movies when my parents took me to this. So they made that decision as well. It's going to have some subject matter you're not used to seeing with us, but it'll be good for you or important for you.
As a film, it's great. Yes. Everything is about it is great. We haven't brought up the score done by my man, John Williams. Mm-hmm. It's another amazing piece. When John Williams watched the rough cut of the film, he said to Spielberg, "I think you need a better composer than me." And Spielberg said, "You're right, but they're all dead."
Just
a hell of a compliment.
Yeah.
And
also, I mean, I should talk about the casting that is very smart.
My introduction to Liam Neeson.
It's most people's introduction to Liam Neeson. Mm-hmm. And he's been around. He's been here. There's a next of kin with Patrick Swayze. He's in Satisfaction.
My mother would famously go to Liam Neeson movies alone. Because she had a huge lady boner for Liam Neeson. So I just associate him with the Rob Roys, the movies my mom was going to quietly mentally jerk to. And
Rob Roy's actually fun. Yeah. I think you would like it. But
I wasn't
allowed
to go.
But the thing that they did was really smart was obviously the studio's like, we want a movie star in this because this is going to be a hard sell to the public. They wanted Harrison Ford. Oof. They talked to Mel Gibson.
Oh.
Which would have been... Oh, Jesus Christ. Maybe things would be different.
That would have been some like meta wrestling kind of reveal later on to make the movie even more entertaining later down the line.
Oh, no. But yeah, Spielberg remembered Liam Neeson from him auditioning for Empire of the Sun, which I think is a very important step towards this movie.
In a fantastic movie. It's much easier to watch a thousand times
over. Super underrated. And just the idea of, like, we need a big guy who can glad-hat everyone and has gravitas to him. And, like, you want to be his buddy. Mm-hmm. He's a salesman, damn it. Ralph Fiennes, this is his first theatrical film. He only previously was in that Lawrence of Arabia TV movie sequel we talked about where he's good, but the whole movie isn't. And he's fucking amazing in this.
Yes.
I mean, because he's a monster, but also we understand what a weak little coward he is underneath.
Yes. And the only strange criticism I have is remembering as a kid, you know, I'm seeing this movie. It's pretty heavy. It's long. My attention is there, but going in and out. And for a while, my memories were that Liam Neeson and Ralph Fiennes were the same person because they look very similar. Yeah, I did. My dumb kid brain did make that association. Apologies.
Do you know who Liam Neeson has just been cast as?
Yeah.
Voldemort?
A reviving a series we will talk about next week.
Wow.
We will talk about the third in a trilogy. And it's
I thought it was the 33rd.
33rd and a third.
Oh!
Don't forget that last third. Yeah. Yes. Which is fantastic casting because he can do serious, and he needs to be very serious while taking on very serious things.
Well, but what I really want to impress upon people is that, like, despite the subject matter as a film, I have watched this since the theater. I've watched it since school. I've watched the Blu-ray. Why was this the cheapest 4K Blu-ray? It was $7 six months ago. I picked it up. I'm like, I know.
Because there's not that many people who are like, I want to watch this five times a year.
Ah, I want to see it with
you. And if you do, you have problems.
What kind of bonus features are on Schindler's List? I don't know if I want to buy it. But yeah, I picked it up for $7. Fucking gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I got to see it again in a new way. And I had a great film time with it, being able to separate. But I also think it's important to do and impress upon you as listeners to watch this again. Spielberg was partially motivated to make this movie because of the rise of Holocaust denialism. I am not an authority to say that is at an all-time high now, but it certainly never affected people I know personally until this year.
I actually have a brief statement I would like to talk about Holocaust denial, but please, we can save that till the end. Go ahead, Jay.
I mean, that's leading to, I've told this anecdote, I feel like a billion times on a podcast, but here we are talking about Schindler's List. I was dabbling between English and film major in college, and I see a class, film class, Robocops, Terminators, and Frankensteins. And I'm like, who in their right mind wouldn't sign up for this class? What I ended up with was a rather challenging ultra feminist, like the whole idea was that men desire to create children without women, and we keep making this movie over and over again, and it was challenging. And there was a section where she was talking about whose perspectives do we see things from, and neither Liam Neeson or Ray Fiennes are there during some of the more horrific sequence, and she's picking up on, like, these are shots lifted from Psycho. When we see these characters enter the bath, and but does that do the story of Schindler's List a disservice by just, these are monsters. You know what monsters are. They're not you. They're not like you. And I don't think that's a fair criticism now that Spielberg talk about how we got to this point in the Holocaust, but it is important reminder. It was an anecdote I was telling to my lady for the same week. People are up in arms about Shane Gillis hosting SNL because he said some naughty words on a podcast 5 years ago. I'm not saying it's not bad. I'm not saying you can't be mad at two things. Joe Rogan and Dr. Phil start perpetuating anger at Chinese immigrants with muscular builds and of military age immigrating to this country. I think one of those is really dangerous, and those are the ingredients that lead you to something like this, perpetuating fear like that. And I'm seeing a lot of that going around now. Though those are the building blocks you don't get in Schindler's List, not that you necessarily need them as a film, but when you start stripping children from their families and dehumanizing people, like, that's those, and I never saw those in my life up until the last 8 or so years. And I think it's more important than ever to realize the Nazis aren't weirdo monsters. They're human beings who turned their scapegoats into enemies and themselves into monsters with whatever solution they arrived on to get rid of what they thought was their major cultural problem. I almost wish they got like another 10 years to be like, yeah, that didn't get rid of any of our problems. Oh my God. Like, maybe the Jews had nothing to do with Germany's ills. It really didn't. Whoops-a-daisy. But we don't have that.
I mean, you could say they kind of did learn that lesson because the world Jewish population has still not recovered.
It's true.
We're still not where we were. Yeah.
Hitler, by and large, achieved nothing in his life. He wanted a great Germany. Germany got divided in two and was weak for a long, long time. He wanted his National Socialism to last for 1,000 years. It lasted 12. He wanted all these things. He wanted a Europe without major Jewish influence, and he kind of got that. Mm. Europe does not have the Jewish culture that it had pre-World War II.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, it wiped out 2/3 of Europe's Jews. And the rest, a lot of them didn't want to go home after that because people didn't want them back. So I refined this. I have a brief statement I would like to read about Holocaust denial. I have refined this down to as few words as possible because one of the reasons I left Twitter was the last straw was the owner backing Great Replacement Theory.
He's moments away from outright Holocaust. Like, within minutes, I think he'll say something.
I believe he actually retweeted something that was like, Great Replacement is real and the Jews are to blame, basically. And that was the point where I was like, normally I'm a stand-and-fight person, but I cannot support this anymore. Before that, this other steps were I got a served an ad that was the 14-word Nazi slogan.
Jesus.
Which is bad on two fronts. Bad that they have that ad and bad that they're sending it to me. And two, I
this is supposed
seeing...
to be a mechanism to target people. Like you're...
Exactly. Like you're targeting the wrong audience. And second, I started seeing so much Holocaust denial just popping up randomly in my feed. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? And I would just report it, block it, and move on. And it's like, is this rage bait to keep me involved, or is this just like accepted?
It's
now?
Free speech, Diana.
It's free speech. So here's what I have to say about Holocaust denial. There are three types of Holocaust deniers: professional contrarians, people who refuse to believe any accepted story from history. They also think the moon landing is fake and Joe Biden's a clone. They like liberals yelling at them because then they feel like they're over the target.
And they get attention.
Exactly. They feel like they have special knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
They're smart.
Yeah.
Number two, the uninformed, people who literally don't have enough information. So when they hear about the enormity of the Holocaust, they have trouble believing it's real. Understandable. Those two groups are targets by group three, Jew haters.
Yep.
People who want to minimize the Holocaust because they support it. They want it to happen again. They've taken the easy explanation for all the world's problems, that there is a group of supervillains. They are trying to recruit you with their Holocaust denial.
Yep. And they're trying to diminish. I didn't think I'd ever have a person in my life who fell victim to this. So I had to read a lot of this literature. And at best, they're trying to... These people are trying to make you feel guilty over a Holocaust that is like 50,000 dead. That's what's... And they're going to use this century-long bit of empathy to try and allow Mexicans to come to this country. That's that's as polite as the anti-Semitism gets. And
right, so...
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, Diana.
Okay, no. The evidence for the Holocaust happening, as it is historically understood, is so overwhelming that every denier argument is about picking out details to miss the obvious.
Yes.
Literally, one chimney versus the testimony of tens of thousands of soldiers and survivors across dozens of camps. One meme about how long it would take to burn bodies versus piles of unburnt bodies.
I remember I had to reach out to Diane and like, I can't believe I have to ask you this, but I need irrefutable evidence that this person, I can send to this person that can believe. And just reading the section on like, these people had families. Like it, you can't make up a million people out of nowhere when this many people went missing. That knew people, they put numbers on them. They were registered. There's a billion ways to have arrived at this figure of 6 million.
Yeah. So. Holocaust deniers lie because they don't want us to learn the essential lesson of the Holocaust, which is civilized modern people in a first world country like you and me are capable of the worst inhumanity.
Perfect.
When we target groups for hate.
Exactly what I was getting. Thank you, Diane. Yes.
Yeah. For the Holocaust to be fake, it would require a greater conspiracy than the Holocaust itself. In case you think Holocaust denial is, you know, just fringe shit that weird Nazis do trying to trick you. This week, the candidate who won the primary for the Republican nomination for governor of North Carolina, he's a Holocaust denier.
Wow.
Yeah. So, North Kakalaki, get off your butts. Go vote for the other guy. Well, no. And here's the fun thing. The other guy is Jewish. So,
hey.
If he loses, then it just fits his narrative and he won't feel so bad.
I didn't lose because Jews.
Because
put it on
Jews.
A bumper sticker.
And in case you didn't think he sucks even more than I could imagine. He dissed Black Panther.
Really?
Well, that's he is a black guy who dissed Black Panther. He said Black Panther was created by Jews to steal money from black people.
What the? And a black Holocaust denier?
Yeah.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
How are we doing this?
When minorities fight amongst themselves, it just hurts my heart. Of like, come on, guys.
Yes, you should be uniting against us. What are you doing?
Yeah, yeah. Don't do the man's work for him.
What are you doing?
Yeah, so Mark Robinson, you fucking suck. North Carolina, please fix this. And if you are still just asking questions, you can go ahead and contact me. I can answer a lot of questions. But if you do, you have to start with answering my question. My grandparents had aunts and uncles and grandparents and cousins in Ukraine and Poland during World War II. Why did we stop hearing from them? And I'm done.
Yep. So my wife's grandparents survived the Holocaust, wow. and we have tape of one of them telling their Holocaust survival story. And it's an incredible moving story because most Holocaust survival stories are incredible.
Yeah.
Because everyone who didn't have an incredible story died. The average Holocaust story is I was told to get on a train. I got on a train. I got off the train and I was murdered. That's the average story. And so their story is one of amazing thing after amazing thing. It's like you just barely survived because if they didn't, my wife wouldn't exist. My kids wouldn't exist. It's
yeah. Okay. I think that's one thing that the movie kind of gets to is that it is just dumb luck that these random people happen to end up in the right place at the right time at a terrible place at a terrible time.
Can I get some clarification? That's the only the Jews in the movie seem to like they're aware of the train situation and what possibly is they're aware of the chamber situation. So like these are at least rumors that have been pervasive. They do know. No one in this movie is surprised by what is going to happen to them, right?
Well, no, they are. I mean, there's the one of the best lines in the movie that kind of sums it all up is, why would they kill us where they're workforce?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, exactly. But the problem is that there's too many of them. They keep talking about and another got 10,000 Hungarians coming through. So we're going to get rid of the old workers and we'll have new workers. That's what the slave labor program was. And the death camps came from, they just still had too many people. So let's just get rid of them. They're not dying fast enough.
Yeah. So long term, this movie is going to have a huge historical impact. Okay. Yeah. I was going to say, I think in the long term, the effect of this film is why Steven Spielberg is going to be remembered.
Wow. You really think so?
Because this is the film. Huh. He said, I'm not going to take any money from this film.
Yeah, he didn't.
That would be blood money. I'm going to use that to help Holocaust foundations. And he started the Shoah Foundation, which to date has recorded over 50,000 videotapes or digital tapes at this point of Holocaust survivors just telling their story. Wow. And I can tell you as a historian, as a history nut, you know, when we are 200 years away from World War II, which is about as far away as we are from the Napoleonic Wars, historians are going to be so grateful that this Mr. Spielberg got together all these recordings that are going to last and be studied and be analyzed and will always be there for historians to just tell this story. We don't have firsthand accounts of people surviving Pompeii or other horrible disasters or the genocides that went to many Native American groups. We don't have very many firsthand accounts, but we will always have these 50,000 audio and video recordings of people just telling their story because of this movie.
I never thought of it like that, just because like, yeah, you're right. There will be a point where, and I don't want to live to see it, where Jurassic Park is unpalatable. It is one of Diana's 1920s Oscar movies. And the more important work of Steven Spielberg will be that. And it's why I get so upset when the younger folks shit on him whenever he like gives a minor criticism to fucking Marvel movies. You leave Spielberg. He's a good man. I love it when he gets into all his movies in a very weird way. I like Jurassic Park. I'm starting a museum. I like World War. Fascinating guy. And
yep. And this is the movie he finally wins an Oscar. Apparently, he's been at this for 20 years now, and he was kind of accepting, like, I'm going to be like Alfred Hitchcock. Mm-hmm. I'm just never going to win an Oscar. And you think about all the movies up to this, E.T. or Raiders or Jaws.
Close Encounters.
Color Purple. Close Encounters.
Yeah.
Shafted on everyone. And there's like, nah.
Producing Back to the Future and Gremlins. And Poltergeist. Yeah. Good Lord.
He won the award for producers, like the Gene, or not Gene Herschel. I'm blanking on his name. Yeah, there's the award that they give for producing. He got that way before he got the director Oscar.
And I don't have anything as poignant to say to Holocaust deniers, but I'm just going to try and be nice about it. When you're considering Holocaust denial, just know you're making the guy who made Jaws sad. Is that one more appeal. Yeah. One more appeal. I just thought it was necessary. You don't want to make the guy who made Jurassic Park sad, do you? Come on.
You're like making Velociraptors cry.
Yeah. Don't make that guy sad. I definitely, you know, had some tears and some shock and a gasp, but I was mostly like Yeah, this film fucking rips. Like, it's...
It moves. For a three-hour movie, it moves. And I will say, probably a lot of people think that it's taking your vegetables, you know. But to compare it to a really strange movie, comparing it to Passion of the Christ, which was a fucking ordeal.
Oh my God.
On purpose. This is not an ordeal. It stays very interesting the whole way through.
Yeah, and I think that's the only thing that makes it the ultimate Holocaust film. The only thing that's a bit of a cheat is all this stuff that happens away from any of the main characters. You get a really close-up look at the mechanisms of the Holocaust without Oscar Schindler or even Goeth being there. Like, it's just, they're just separated for 30 minutes at a time, but it has its cake and eats it too. But it's important. I think it's more important than just focusing on that character. That character being a gateway to seeing, I want to say, one of the more accurate depictions of the Holocaust, and expensive. But this film wasn't terribly expensive. And that is also hilarious. I looked up, we all saw this movie, and Universal was kind enough to, like, it didn't charge a lot of people for it. There was a lot of ways to see this movie for nothing, because it was more important than it was needing to make its $22 million back. Holy shit, does that seem paltry? That is that's actually close to Jurassic
Park. That's one-third the budget of Jurassic Park, which honestly is a huge financial commitment to make to a movie that's not a blockbuster.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah, and I think that helped solidify its legacy. But then I looked and, like, this made $300 million domestic. This is an astounding success, a crowd pleaser just in terms of finances. People went all over the globe, and this movie, it wasn't even... 12 Years a Slave did not do that kind of business at all, not even close. Made its money back, but, like, this is where, like, somebody... I know you're going to hate me. Think it's got... We got to talk sequel. This made way too much money.
Well, okay, that's crass. You could absolutely make a sequel about these people's lives after the Holocaust. Where did they go? Did they go to Israel? Did they stay in Europe? Did they live under the communists? Did they get to America? What happened to any of these groups of people would be a fascinating story.
And then cut to the Gaza Strip. I did not mean to be that crass there, but
That is a corollary to Holocaust denial. You got the Nazi kind, and then you got the pro-Palestinian kind, where it's like, you hate Israel for political reasons, and you have taken that to an extreme to be like, oh, that thing that makes everyone sad about Jews, that didn't happen. Mm. It's like, yeah, no, we did get Israel out of this deal, and you can feel any way you want about that. I feel a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But there is a certain amount of, where's everyone supposed to go now?
Yeah. Yeah. But more than anything, I want to impress upon people, watch this again. You'll get something else out of it. It's beyond an important story. It didn't feel like homework to me at all. And it didn't fill me with the kind of rage 12 Years a Slave did, but it pressed upon me the importance of keeping this film in the zeitgeist and not something you kind of groan. Like, we definitely did off mic. Like, we have to do this long, sad movie, but I'm so glad we, and just because, you know, behind the scenes, we cut corners in our viewing sometimes. You watch Double Speed, I'll watch while playing video games. I knew I needed to, like, put the phone down one viewing. Yep. I need to sit here and do this. And my only cheat was to drink and then follow it up by watching Disney's Wish for the first time. And after I did a little research on the movie, I could no longer see the television, because this is a very, very long thing we did for 2010. And it was like 4 a.m. by the time following up on stuff was done. But I encourage you to not think of it as vegetables. If they're vegetables, they're cooked and caramelized and stuffed with ground beef and spices. It's good. It's good. I thoroughly recommend it. And it's one of those things, I don't have much of a problem with this being as shorthand for a very important historical story as it was for my generation. There are much more worse ways to go about that, I suppose.
It's called Boy in Striped Pajamas. Don't watch that one.
Yeah. Like learning about Cleopatra or Liz Taylor. Like, it could be a lot worse.
Yeah. Who's not worse?
Well, yeah, Diana. How many times do you think you've watched? Have you? When I had very few movies, I had Schindler's List, and I would pop it on occasion.
I know I saw it in theaters in like late January, mm-hmm. 94. I remember I went by myself, and then afterwards I just sort of sat in the car for a while. Mm-hmm. Didn't cry, didn't get upset, just sort of soaked it in. Mm. I was just like, yeah, mostly just the idea of man's inhumanity to man, mm-hmm. and the sheer fucking randomness of who lives and who dies. And then I believe I saw it in 2000 when NBC broadcast it with limited commercials.
Yeah.
Because I remember who my roommates were at the time, so that would make it 2000 or late 99.
2000? I remember that happened to me in high school. Whatever.
And then I don't think I watched it again, because it's sort of like, I got it. I was like, yeah, but like over time, it's taken on this sort of affect of like, this is this holy sacred object. It's so important that it's like, I can barely look at it. It's so, like, how could you criticize this? It's so perfect. And it's like, it's just a movie.
Yeah.
It's a really well-made movie.
Yeah, I think...
Of course it has flaws. Yes, of course it has flaws. Every movie has flaws, except for Magic Mike XXL.
And Flight of the Navigator.
Fine.
Let's put Schindler's List up there with that one. I think it belongs
okay.
there.
All right.
But yeah, it's there is a movie-ass movie in here.
Yeah, there's still just a movie-ass movie, and it is interesting and really well done. And just also, like, I'm always taken with the logistics when I think about this doesn't have digital effects, and you realize there is a scene where someone's standing on a balcony, and there are hundreds of extras running amok in the background.
Dude, some
of them had to choreograph that shit.
Some, like, even when there's like a brief scene of Oskar Schindler walking through a factory of surplus pots, and it just, like, that's an astonishing set to put together.
They had to make all those pots.
Yep. Yeah, like that is just incredible.
And they don't look like modern pots. They look like you made like this in time. World War II out of scraps.
I only had one note on that in the beginning when they arrive at the train station and the guy who does the stamps sets up a table. That's my TV dinner table. The exact one. I thought we have not made any progress in that regard.
Actually, I realized that was one thing that definitely struck me on this rewatch that I somehow did not put in my notes was the emphasis on bureaucracy, mm-hmm. and that the movie does open with all the tables and the pens and the paper and the lists, and that becomes a recurring theme. It's like there are lists, and if you're on the list, you're fucked, or if there's lists, you're on the list, you got a work permit, so maybe you'll live a little bit longer. And really spending time on the paperwork involved, which is a huge part of the evidence, everybody. The Germans fucking loved paperwork.
Remember when you deny again, there's this movie with the word list in it. Germans love lists.
They really do.
Love lists.
My God, they love lists. It's incredible how much paperwork. I read something, it was something like 3 tons of paperwork was used
wow.
in the Nuremberg trials. Like, okay, that's a lot of paperwork.
Wow.
And
this is where scapegoating and racism and bigotry event. This is
yep.
a major end of the road for that kind of stuff. So, you know, be careful with that, America. Come on.
Come on. That is the whole point why we say never again. It's like there have been a lot of genocides and they all deserve attention. This one is the worst one for a reason.
Yeah.
Because this is the natural progression where you end up.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm going to give this a light recommend. Just kidding. Very, very recommend. Show your kids. Show someone. I reached out to show someone who needed to see it. They said no, but I reached out. And I encourage you to do the same. I tried. And it's good. Everybody will not be miserable. They watched it. Check it out. It's not streaming free anywhere, but you might be able to check. It has, you can rent it in 4K everywhere. And that's, I kind of watched Schindler's List with every new format that it came on. And that's kind of been my cycle. I pick it up, I watch it once, and then move on to a couple of our next films because there.
I was trying to think of the most tasteless transition I could do. And
sometimes,
well, the last movie takes place in the 40s and this one takes place in the 50s. So should I just start with
empathy,
my Howard Hawks lady voice again?
Empathy is like tests, and sometimes you gotta guard it. Guard it. Okay, no, that was
well,
a much
better. No, that movie's about a list, and this movie's about a letter.
Hey!
Hey! Hey!
You know.
The letter O. I love this fucking movie.
I mean, I know, massive hard pivot, but now we have to talk about a couple movies that are they're memorable and they're better known than they were then.
Yeah.
We had a couple fucking failures, and you guys, Chris, you started to argue with me last week as I teased this, saying, how could you say that movie's a failure? This movie was a fucking failure when it was released.
It is the only Coen Brothers movie I own digitally because I need access to it constantly. It is Raising Arizona is their best cartoon. This kind of is way more expensive and way more elaborate and way prettier to look upon. Paul Newman, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Tim Robbins in The Hudsucker Proxy.
We need now is a new president. Some jerk.
My leg is on fire.
We can really push around.
Yo! Yeah, you, Barnes! This letter was sent down this morning by the big man himself.
Sit down, go ahead. Try it on.
Did the board consider you an idea man when they promoted you from the mailroom?
Well, I guess so. I don't think they promoted me because they thought I was a schmo.
The guy's a real moron.
Cigarettes?
No, thank you.
What an imbecile. Come up with this.
Circle. Oh, man. I highlighted a couple weeks ago and, you know, sorry if it sounds like I'm tooting my own horn. I'm seeing a bunch of people write more about the Coen Brothers because they quietly disbanded, although not permanently, and both of their projects are available to watch separate from the world. And it's fascinating. Oh, Ethan's the funny guy. And Joel is the serious guy. Holy shit. And like, they absolutely need one another to balance those instincts out. And that's why all their movies are like, one is super serious, the next one's super silly. And they have one another to balance them out. This, I will accept an argument, is not as balanced. But that is why it is the greatest Tim Robbins performance in history. It is awesome.
It is definitely at the end of his run of playing big lugs.
Big, tall doofuses.
He played a lot of big doofuses. And this might be the end of the run. I think even going all the way back to Howard... Well, Duck,
yeah,
and Bull Durham. Bull Durham. He plays big doofuses. Later on this year, he'll go to prison, so that'll get the doofus.
No
right
one
out,
remembers though. That performance.
No. Inarguably worse than Norville. Norville absolutely is. Texas Bosom.
Well, he's from Muncie, Indiana.
A real
Muncie.
He's
so proud of it.
I sure do trust a Muncie girl.
Yeah. Well, look, yeah. I mean, the thing is, okay, so Hudsucker Proxy, I can explain what it's about, but really all you need to know is they took Frank Capra movies, Preston Sturges movies, and My Girl Friday, and they put them in a super collider. And then they spent a fucking ton of money on some beautiful models, and no one sort of, it didn't really connect at the time. I think it's found its audience. I think people finally realized what they were going for, how... Because they're coming off of Barton Fink, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Barton Fink. So I watched this film when I was 15 from the rental store because I was hearing all about these Coen brother boys and just getting into film. Nope, I noped out. 15-year-old me could not get into it. Turned it off after about the first half hour. I didn't have Diana's repertoire of historical movie knowledge, so everything was like lost on me.
Mm.
Watching it as a 45-year-old, I'm like sucked in instantly, loving every minute of it. The sets are gorgeous. I mean, just seeing them use these
miniatures,
mnemonic tubes.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks so cool. Will anyone 80 years from now ever make email look cool? I don't think you can. I think those tubes are always just going to be way cooler.
It is best tube since Brazil. And there's some fantastic miniature work in here. Like the opening, a little more happy, a little more gay. Norville Bond, like a fucking wonderful narrator, a fairy tale sense of wonder, a beautiful. Is there any sequence better in the world than the hula hoop sequence? That is awesome.
And we have Sam Raimi to thank for that.
Yeah.
So this is the only movie the Coen brothers ever co-wrote, and they co-wrote it with Sam Raimi. And he played a big part in this film.
If you are a huge nerd, in the movie Crime Wave, they escape from Hudsucker Prison. And if you look at the outfit in Raising Arizona that High is wearing, it is a Hudsucker logo. So this is like their weirdo Rick Darris thing that's been lightly mentioned in numerous movies. The Hudsucker company finally gets shown.
Yeah. Well, they wrote this like back in 85.
Mm-hmm.
I think they might have written this before Blood Simple even. And it's too weird. I was gonna like it, but you know, these are the kind of movies we like. We like those kind of, you know, Mr. Deeds or Meet John Doe or, you know, Sullivan's Travels, you know, that sort of thing. So they, you know, they win the Palme d'Or for freaking Barton Fink, and they con Joel Silver into giving them the money.
Holy shit,
Joel
Warner Silver's Brothers very money. Yeah, big, big Warner. But then conversely, a lot of my friends love this because that means, unlike a lot of other Coen Brothers movies, this isn't rated R and this is owned by Warner Brothers. That means it got screened on HBO a billion fucking times. Might have bombed at the box office, but was shown again and again and again and again to a new generation that may not know the Coen Brothers are.
But yeah, it is so goofy, and it does take a while to, like, it's kind of weird to explain that it's like, okay, this affable big doofus gets a job in the mailroom at this big company. The CEO jumps out of a window and they decide, we're going to buy back all his stock, but first let's tank the stock price so it's cheap. So let's put the doofus in charge.
Yes.
And then the doofus comes up with the dumbest idea ever, which is a circle. And they're like, yes, spend all that money on his circle plan. But it's the hula hoop and it catches on.
I love how many circles are brilliant ideas in this film, because it's a running gag. It's not just the hula hoop. There's a couple of others where it's like a guy just draws a circle and it's like the best idea ever.
Yep. With the frisbee is one, bendy straws. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah, it's just a circle. Yeah, the plot is they tried to producers their own company. We're going to talk about that again later.
Oh, not counting the mezzanine.
I love Jennifer Jason Leigh in this movie. I cannot imagine. They talked to a bunch of other different actresses. I cannot imagine any of them getting that 30s Hoxian patter Jennifer Jason Leigh can.
This is her greatest performance, too.
So funny. Because, yeah, she really does feel like she's wandered in from a she stepped era. Out of an actual movie screen.
And the little bit of Bruce Campbell you get, man, he's perfect in this.
Yep. Yeah, it does feel, there are some sequences that feel very Raimi, though, that when there's the fight at the clock, behind the clock face, like,
yeah, so cool.
This feel like you could tell me Spider-Man's in this and I'd believe you.
Here's what I'll say about it. If you like Coen Brothers movie, they make cheap independent movies and probably give their actors scale. This is them given a really big blockbuster budget. And I don't know that they'll get that outside of Netflix again. So we'll see.
Yeah. I don't feel like they spent it where it needed to go. Like, it does look gorgeous compared to, so many of the movies
sets,
are gorgeous.
The sets should have, did they get an Oscar nod for the sets? Yeah. They should have.
Don't know if they did, but yeah, like they're not used to spending money on sets. Like if the movie is beautiful, it's because the outdoors are beautiful, you know, or a hallway.
This old
is
piece
beautiful.
Of architecture, but this is like executive offices that are 30 feet high ceilings, miniature New York in the winter. Those falling sequences are so Wile E. Coyote brought to life. If Warner isn't going to release that movie, this is as close as you're going to get.
Yeah. They do love Wile E. Coyote. That's who Nicolas Cage is playing in Raising Arizona, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's Wile E. Coyote. Yeah. Coen Brothers fans, if you might have missed this one, hearing that it wasn't very good at the time, they're wrong. A couple weeks from now, we will talk about the Coen Brothers movies that is the only, I'd say, complete failure across the board.
And
This ain't fucking it.
I know exactly which one you're talking about. No, this is actually like, I mean, if I'm well enough aware of my personality, if Big Lebowski wasn't the type of movies that has whole festivals surrounding it, I would have been the person championing it from the beginning. I was obsessed with that movie the week it came out when no one was on board. But it found its audience. This hasn't yet, I don't think, and it deserves one.
It's definitely gotten, I mean, its reputation for at least 10 years was like, it was a swing and a miss. And then people kind of readopted it and went back and realized, like, no, they're just trying something different. This is, I can't even say it's an homage to the kind of things that they love. I think they just wanted to make the kind of movie that they love.
Mm-hmm.
What's interesting to me is after this is Fargo, and then after that is the Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if this was a detour or maybe it was just a necessary step for them.
I can't tell, but it's still unique amidst a resume of all unique movies. And that, I think it deserves credit for that alone. Mostly because it's a big studio film. They don't really make those.
No, this is probably why. The studio's like, you sons of bitches. We give you money for that Barty Fink feeling, and what the hell do we get? We get Jennifer Jason Leigh talking a mile a minute and telling someone that
I need more.
Get some moxie and get that story on the front page.
Bromo. promo. I love it. It is a big cartoon.
He's got lumbago.
Man, this is not streaming free anywhere except for Canopy, which I can never get to work. It's Hudsucker Proxy, the highest possible recommendation for me. Man, we are nowhere near done with the movies. This is a long one. Next up, kind of if you like an anti-Christmas film, this has become a holiday classic for a lot of people that I know. Judy Davis, Kevin Spacey, Dennis Leary in The Ref.
I have a gun. It's loaded. Shut up.
They're a couple at the end of their marriage.
That was a lie.
We haven't had sex in quite a while.
What are we, girlfriends here?
He's a criminal.
You think death scares me? I've been married to him for 15 years.
At the end of his rope.
I just beat up Santa Claus.
Dennis Leary. The Ref.
You want to have sex with him?
Rated R.
Crazy to think about for me. Ted Demme weirdly defines a lot of MTV for me growing up, in that he's a huge director of Yo MTV Raps and Dennis Leary's No Cure for Cancer / the interstitials he'd do on MTV. His first two movies are Who's the Boss and this.
You mean Who's the Man?
Who's the Man? Sorry, Who's the Man?
No, Who's the Man?
With Dr. Dre and Ed Lover from Yo MTV Raps, and the guy who does the stuff in between Yo MTV Raps. This is MTV coming to movie theaters, weirdly, but disguised as, what would you call it, kidnapped therapy comedy?
I guess so. I'm not a fan of the title. Mm-hmm. It's called Hostile Hostages in most of the English-speaking world besides the U.S., and that is a much better title because that's the whole idea. It's kind of a Ransom of Red Chief situation where we have, you know, a criminal takes his couple hostage and all they do is bicker and fight and they're miserable to be around and it drives him insane. That's it. There you go. There's the movie. I love Judy Davis in this movie so fucking much.
But it's good.
She's amazing across the board. Like, she can do fucking everything. She is the driest, meanest person in this, where you still are like, God damn, I just want to buy you a drink. You have problems, girl. You need to get out of here.
I
did not realize this was written by Richard LeGravenaise.
Me neither.
He also wrote The Fisher King.
Oh.
He wrote it with, like, his sister-in-law, I think, of just, like, everything bad that's ever happened at a family dinner. Let's just put in a movie.
Yeah, and I have graduated out of anti-Christmas movie in this stage of my life, but when I wasn't, like, cool, it's a good holiday movie for people who don't like holiday movies. It's a, mean comedy.
Yeah, it really is, and it's annoying that they set it up as, like, this Dennis Leary vehicle when, I mean, it doesn't have to be Dennis Leary, it could be anybody.
They were trying to make Dennis Leary a thing.
Well,
yeah.
Ted Demme had made Dennis Leary a thing.
Yep.
If you haven't seen No Cure for Cancer in a while, it is one of the best directed comedy specials I've ever seen. And knowing most of the material is stolen, it's thoroughly enjoyable. Big fan of The Ref.
No, I'm a big fan of The Ref, too. This is my kind of Christmas movie. It still ends up being like a nice Christmas, even though everything is horrible. It kind of blends in my head with Home Alone. I think that would be a good double feature.
I do have a similar house.
Yeah, a big house at Christmas, a criminal or two shows up, and everything goes wrong. Yeah.
Perfect. The next movie is so fun to talk about. It's Beverly D'Angelo, Cuba Gooding Jr., and the legendary Paul Hogan in Lightning Jack.
Paul Hogan's back as Lightning Jack.
Oh, just now I'm good. Real good.
And he's teaching his new partner everything he knows about gunplay. Horseplay and foreplay.
It's just simple, riding a horse.
Paul Hogan, Cuba Gooding Jr., Lightning Jack, rated PG-13.
Oof, it's so weird because Paul Hogan was kind of a pop cultural punchline even at the time this movie came out.
Yeah, it was his desperate attempt to be someone other than Crocodile Dundee. It was just like, I can play other parts too, people.
Nope.
And we said, no, you cannot, Paul.
I mean, he sort of can't. He's a funny outlaw scamp that women want to fuck. And he's playing almost the exact same character in this. It is more funny that I think we discovered this like our first year of 2010. Crocodile Dundee 1, like, still one of the highest grossing comedies of all time. It cost $6 million, made 400. It's an incredible profit off of a very small thing based on the personality of one guy. Even if his name is kind of mud, it's worth another shot. It is hilarious that he founded a company and listed it on the Australian stock market to finance this film. That is how we get here. I don't know how he did something like that so fast. Maybe financial rules are different over there. But nobody liked this.
I remember him promoting it. I remember him being like on the late night talk shows, being like, I'm taking this to the people of Australia. They can vote with their dollar. Mm-hmm. You're investing in me. You're investing in Australia.
Oh my God.
It was unlisted from the stock market a few years later. Lightning Jack. Holy shit.
I mean, I guess making a Western with them seems like a logical step.
Totally.
I suppose.
That, it was hilarious.
Because it's like the same guy. That's why.
If you look at the director's like, it was so hard to shoot because everybody was using this to shoot more Westerns. They're shooting Tombstone and City Slickers 2, like right over the hill making a shitload of noise.
Paul Hogan just needed to get his card punched and play Ned Kelly. That's his mistake.
Yeah.
He is too old for that.
It worked for Yahoo Sirius.
Play Ned Kelly's dad.
Lightning Jack. Right. And then lastly.
Next movie. I am so disappointed by this movie.
Yeah. Austin Pendleton, Nicolas Cage, and Shirley MacLaine. Number one at the box office. It's Guarding Tess.
As a Secret Service agent.
A special agent, are we?
He will take a bullet for her.
Be a dear and get me a baby, Ruth.
Lay down his life for her.
I need a price check and Lasore baby peas. Repeat, Lasore baby peas.
They're on special today.
But every man has his limits.
You'll be kind enough to get my ball.
What do we look like, waiters? Are we a bunch of waiters?
Shirley MacLaine, Nicolas Cage.
Why me?
Because I like you, Douglas.
Guarding Tess.
What was with us in Secret Service movies back then? Jesus.
How did they get this so wrong? I don't understand. Like that ad makes me think, okay, so Shirley MacLaine is a major pill. She's a former first lady. She's going to be like her character in Steel Magnolias.
Steel Magnolias.
And Nicolas Cage, and she's going to drive Nicolas Cage as a Secret Service agent crazy. Okay. Movie starts. He's been the Secret Service agent for years and he's leaving and then she makes him come back. And then there's some shenanigans, and then we find out she has a brain tumor. There's a couple more shenanigans, and then she gets kidnapped and buried alive. There's a
pretty sizable tonal shift in this lighthearted comedy.
What the crap? Yeah, kidnapped and buried alive. And then they have to, like, deal with all the other feds, and then they save her, and then, like, everybody hugs at the end. I was like, what was that?
I did see the comparison. It's like In the Line of Fire meets Driving Miss Daisy. And
that would have been good. That's not what this is, though. There's like one or two scenes that are what you want it to be, which is, you know, her driving him insane until him boiling until he fucking loses it.
But
there's like a tiny bit of that. And then it's so sappy by the end. You're like, what the fuck?
But also fascinating, this is what the public went to see the most this week. And it's not because of Nicolas Cage, because he's not like a huge bankable movie star until like a year or two from now.
He's a decent sized star.
Is he?
He's B plus at this point.
Like he's just been in Wild at Heart. I don't feel like most people don't know who he is.
Moonstruck, bitch.
Oh, right.
He's
was
been
in Moonstruck.
A whole bunch of stuff.
That's true.
But he's like B plus. He's not an A-list yet.
I have to imagine a lot of people showing up for Shirley MacLaine in 1994.
Fuck
which
yeah.
feels insane, but like number one at the box office.
Yeah, how I would, man. That? I was thinking the other day, how many actors do we have left that work with Hitchcock? I came up with like five, and most of them are in their 90s. Shirley MacLaine's 89, I think.
Wow.
And Bruce Dern. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Never forget. Bruce Dern will never die.
I don't think he can.
He can't. After a feature-length recording, let's move into television. We can probably keep this brief because it's a TV movie, Heart of Darkness with Tim Roth and John Malkovich.
Pretty clean adaptation directed by Nicholas Roeg. It's the only thing that makes me interested in it. It got really good reviews.
This was and this is what I was teasing earlier. Way too late for me to enjoy. One of my favorite childhood things ever was Richard Scarry. And I remember as a little kid being afraid of the doctor so much. And then one day they put up a mural of a Richard Scarry mural in one of the doctor's offices. And it had such a calming effect on me. I think it was referenced by either Seth Meyers or John Oliver the other day when I was watching stuff with my lady. And I was just like, I think that's the tattoo. The first tattoo, the worm driving the apple, like that. that brings like a real sense of calm over me for some reason. But Showtime, where I definitely couldn't see it, 8 years too late, we get The Busy World of Richard Scarry, finally, an animated form of one of the coolest looking things of my childhood. Busy World of Richard
Scarry.
There's
a meme that goes around, and it's a guy in a psychiatrist's office. The psychiatrist says, "You seem disappointed in life. What were you expecting?" And then it's him thinking of Richard Scarry's drawings.
That's I said that somewhere else, but like we borrowed a Brooklyn apartment on Thanksgiving, and I'd never been in New York when it was that cold, and I just went out on this third floor balcony on Thanksgiving, and that's what it looked like. It looked like New York on Thanksgiving, a bunch of different colored people in huge outfits, all doing things that I could see clearly. It was beautiful. Moving on. Why am I elongating this? Thunder Alley premieres. This isn't the Hulk Hogan show, is it? That's Thunder in Paradise.
I kept thinking, too. It's such a confusing title.
It's about a retired race car driver who moves in with his daughter and her family.
It's Ed Asner and Haley Joel Osment, age 5.
I absolutely watched like every episode of this. Holy shit. This is how I was introduced to Ed Asner, for fuck me.
Oh my God.
JR, what do we got up next? I'm assuming this is you.
The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr. Ned Zed.
Ned Zed.
At first you think it's going to be a clip show, which, you know, in the days before YouTube and the internet, I actually didn't mind clip shows.
Me neither.
It was like, you know.
Simpsons, Seinfeld, those great clip shows.
They do a bit of a swerve, and it turns out we're seeing a grandfather reading an old dime store novel to his grandson, and it's The Adventures of Briscoe County Jr.
Oh, neat. Okay. And then last and absolutely leastly, maybe this will be the last time we talk about this woman. Saturday Night Live, hosted by Nancy Kerrigan. For my money, the worst host, and it's not her fault, but it's one of the worst hosts I remember ever seeing. I don't remember the audience being like just quiet, but there's several sketches where you can hear people's like tying their shoes in the audience during this episode. Nancy mm-hmm. Kerrigan hosting the Disney
How
World.
How many jokes can there be about she figure skates?
Exactly.
How many?
Wayne Gretzky's episode was funnier, and he is one of the worst actors I've ever seen on SNL in my life.
Oh, but this was, oh gosh, I forgot about the controversy about mm-hmm. her at the Disney World parade, because we're after the Olympics now, and her saying that something was really corny.
Yeah, this is the corniest thing I've ever done.
It's Disney World, bitch. Of course it is.
And
people got so offended that she would call a Disney parade corny.
It was like a hot mic situation is why it became national news, because she was doing the parade and then it was like broadcast. This is the corniest thing I ever done. And this is her response.
I'd like to clear something up. When I was at Disney World on the float with Mickey, what I actually said was, "This is the horniest thing I've ever done." But the real reason I'm happy to be on the show tonight.
All right, good laugh. But those Disney sketches are abysmal. They're pretty awful. Zero laughs from the audience. Punctuated every time where they're saying, "Now this is really corny." Yeah, man, great week for video games. None of these developers gave a shit that they'd go up against Schindler's List. It's time for Claymates. Claymates has to happen. Why?
What?
Diana, fighting games are huge. Mechanics aren't important. It's all about the conceit of what you bring into it. And by this, we mean claymation, because that was something the market was asking for. Claymates.
But this is actually the spinoff from that, where it's not a fighting game, but it is a 2D scroller, also in that claymation style.
Which is where it belonged from the beginning. Even better, Diana, classic movie mm-hmm. reference from the 1940s. Why not in our 90s video games, which is also based on a 1960s cartoon? The Flintstones, the treasure of Sierra Madre Rock. We don't need no stinking badges, Bon.
So is Fred going to stay up for days on end because he's so paranoid and he goes insane?
No, it's a stupid treasure thing set in their modern day and is not Western in the slightest. I don't know why they called it this. Mostly you encounter a lot of the guys in the Loyal Order of Buffalo outfits because they're all after this treasure for some reason. JR, help me out here with Star Trek The Next Generation. Futures Past. Is that Super Nintendo 2?
another crappy Star Trek game. It's so hard to capture the Star Trek vibe with 16 bits.
Yeah.
And I don't think anyone succeeded.
How can we capture a captain's ennui by allowing him to run right? It's up next, Equinox. Equinox.
Sequel to Solstice. It's another isometric puzzle game. Traps, monsters, puzzles. Personally, I think isometrics was never the great way to do a video game.
Except there's a couple of great racing. I do like my RC Pro-Ams. Gober Triangles. The Peacekeepers is out this week. And
beat 'em up.
And my,
that's how you keep the peace.
I don't know if this is... Yes, walk right, take everyone down. Indiscriminately.
Punch.
And my favorite, least favorite title of all time... Young Merlin. Young Merlin. When you're, if you're in a pitch meeting and have nothing else, just throw out Young Merlin in there. Young Merlin. Merlin. Yeah, I don't know anything about Young Merlin, but it makes me laugh looking at it. Say it like David Tell. Merlin. It'll make you laugh even more. Music of 1994, 30 years ago. Brutal Youth by Elvis Costello is out this week. Just saw him perform live. Hard to Earn by Gangstar. Martinis and Bikinis by Sam Phillips. Ringmaster by Insane Clown Posse is out. Yes, there, we mentioned it. Please don't blow us up. Great album. Your Filthy Little Mouth by David Lee Roth. Vauxhall and I by Morrissey. And The Downward Spiral by Nine Inch Nails and Super Unknown by Soundgarden, which are both on Rolling Stone's top 500 albums list.
Fuck. And yes.
Yes.
They are. God damn them albums. Oh, those are good albums. Really good for sitting around and moping.
Yes. Wondering why that lady you like doesn't understand you.
No one understands me, Chris.
I know. Just wait. 30 years from now, you'll have a podcast where you talk 8 hours a week. People will understand way more about you than you ever wanted them to. None of those are number one on the charts. That belongs to Ace of Base, The Sign. Is it about being a Nazi? Probably not, but it did have that theory around it. But Ace of Base, again, music I remember being so mind-blowing to kids in the pop world that everyone was talking about Ace of Base. It was huge. And this is their titular song off that album, isn't it? The Sign. So we'll go out with that. But stay tuned. There's surprisingly, well, more than half the show left. Coming in with Come On, Come On by the Von Bondies off of Pawn Shop Heart. This is Dennis Leary's firefighting show, Rescue Me. No, it is the second segment of 302010, but you'll remember it from that show, which loved music. Man, did they, every single episode closed with a goofy, sappy montage set to a popular song. Anyway, 2004, 20 years ago, other new music releases include 667... The Neighbor of the Beast by Wigwam, a band I would not have known about if not for the intro to Peacemaker.
But yes, I have really enjoyed Wigwam since then. I'm like, oh, Scandinavian hair metal? Okay.
New hair metal, like yes. Of the 2000s era. And you don't get 667, The Neighbor of the Beast is a great album title. Jesus Christ. Suburban Rock and Roll by Space. Desperate Youth, A Bloodthirsty Babes by TV on the Radio. And Into the Now by Tesla, the one that doesn't make you look like a douchebag. Yeah, by Usher featuring Lil Jon and Ludacris is still number one. A little bit of news bringing the wonderful world 20 years ago. Terrorists explode 10 simultaneous bombs on 4 trains near Madrid 3 days before the election, killing 193 people.
Yeah, this is Spain's 9/11. Mm-hmm. They call it 11M over there. And it's also the worst terrorist attack since the Lockerbie bombing on the plane that blew up. It's pretty impressive that they pulled this off. I mean, 10 bombs go off within like 4 minutes of each other on 4 different trains, multiple bombs in multiple trains. I think one of the victims died 10 years later So RIP to that guy who's in a coma for 10 years after this freaking bombing.
Say, that's some slow-moving shrapnel.
The terrorists got 43,000 years was their sentence.
Jesus.
But due to Spanish law, you can only serve 40 years before you're released. So these guys are about halfway through their sentencing.
Okay, yeah,
and then there was, because obviously it's 3 days before the election, it becomes a whole big thing of Al-Qaeda did it, no, the Basque separatists did it, and you know, it becomes this whole political thing of everyone trying to blame everyone else so they'll do better in the election. It turns out no, it's pretty much just random guys who were opposed to Spain being involved in Iraq.
Wow.
And that's like even worse, it's just random guys.
Yeah.
Fuck those guys.
And then in other geopolitical news, Roo Moo-hyun, did I say that right? President of South Korea is impeached by its National Assembly for the first time in the nation's history. Then the Constitutional Court overruled it, and he returned to the presidency in May. All that for nothing. What?
Yeah, it got really complicated where he started a new political party and they're like, you can't do that. And then they threw him out of office. But then that political party won a bunch in the election. And then the court was like, OK, maybe not. I don't know. I'm so envious of people who actually throw their presidents out of office.
I'm envious of people who pull a Michael Scott and get purchased by their start a new paper company and then it gets bought by their old one. And anyway,
that's kind of what happened.
And then the movies of 2004, Passion of the Christ is still number one at the box office because Christians all have money for some reason.
Wait, is this a conspiracy theory that the Christians run the banks and the Hollywood and the businesses?
I mean, why not? The town I grew up in, I'm like, yeah, I went to this awesome summer camp where they had like 30 Nintendos back when that costs a lot. And it didn't, and a pool and a slide and an indoor gym and an arts and crafts department and Cokes and treats. And it didn't cost that. Why didn't it cost that much? We had to go to church once a week because it was rich Baptist money. Siphoning up secular kids into their claws. Still resent it. Anyway, movies this week. Clark Gregg, Tia Texada, Kristen Bell, Ed O'Neill, Bill Macy, and Derek Luke and Val Kilmer in Spartan.
Oh. So David Mamet's gonna make a I mean it's a thriller. Mm-hmm. Like kind of, it's like Secret Service spy type thriller. Tom Clancy, that's what I was going for. He's kind of making a Tom Clancy, and he's doing a pretty good job. This ends up kind of becoming the basis for the show The Unit that he made, which went for 4 seasons.
Unit,
I know.
Oh, from the Shield people, yes.
Yeah, but it's not bad. I wish Val Kilmer had done more stuff kind of like this. President's daughter goes missing. They think she's dead, or maybe she's been trafficked. Let's find out if she's trafficked. Oh, she's Kristen Bell. Hey, look at that. And everyone's double-crossing everyone else as they try to get to the root of busting these bastards. And, you know, it was sort of like a B-minus kind of like, yeah, if you want something Clancy-ish, sure.
No, but this week is a giant smattering of no for me. Including the next film, Cynthia Stevenson, Hannah Spirit, Anthony Anderson, and Frankie Muniz. It's Agent Cody Banks 2, Destination London.
At a secret government facility, Agent Cody Banks has been trained to handle any situation.
Attention all campus, code 42.
Even Parents Day.
Secret Agent.
But on March 12th,
you're the man, Cody!
He's got a new partner.
You sleep with a blankie?
Blankie. It's a handkerchief.
And a whole new adventure.
Are you telling me that the CIA was behind Beanie Babies?
These are no ordinary Beanie Babies.
Agent Cody Banks, Destination London, rated PG.
You got your Keith David in there. His M.
Worth it just to hear him say these are no ordinary Beanie Babies.
These are no ordinary Beanie Babies.
I was not going to watch this. No! Anyone?
No, of course not.
No, this is not made for me, and my kids are past this age.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
No.
Here's the one thing.
The reviews were pretty much like, this is for tiny babies. Even middle-aged kids are not going to go for this.
And that's, I feel like, Hollywood, when making movies for kids, always overestimates the appeal of going to Europe. That is something I feel like you need to be in your late teens or 20s to aspire to, No one wants to see their favorite movie star go there. No one wants to see the Muppets go there. It's
hey, what? That's my favorite one.
Most Wanted?
No.
Oh.
Yeah, Muppet Caper.
Yeah, Caper's great. But I love Most Wanted. I think it's amazing. It killed the Muppets franchise, though. It still makes me sad.
Only thing that would make me remotely interested in this series, if they go with the proposed sequel.
Yes.
Which is where Cody Banks is training a new group of teenage spies while being described as a washed-up loser trying to regain the spy credibility from his youth, a la BoJack Horseman.
Dude.
That I would watch.
Is that actually proposed? I would love that.
That is an actual proposed
Let me top it there, because let's be clear. This is a dead franchise, like what they did with the Banana Splits a while ago and put them in a horror movie. They'd be more profitable doing porn at this point. Dead brand. So is Cody Banks. All of the kids he trains in the movie, they should die. And Cody Banks has to get revenge on them. And he finds his spirit again at the ripe age of 39.
I was going to say, wait, you're going to MacGruber this? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I'm going to Mission Impossible.
Gets a team together and then blows them up.
Yeah. Yeah, they're all wrestlers too. That'd be great. And the next movie is remarkable for me for one reason only. And I really hope it happens in the clip Diana included.
It's not the. I looked so hard for the clip with the line that you remember from it, and I couldn't find it, and I'm so mad.
It was definitely a lot of TV spots, so they might not have been archived as well. Len Carew, Charles Dutton, Rock, Timothy Hutton, Maria Bello, John Turturro, and Johnny Depp in a Stephen King adaptation, Secret Window.
Mort Rainey writes stories that scare you to death. But now,
hello.
One story.
Oh, what's wrong?
Is coming back to haunt him.
I don't believe I know you.
That doesn't matter. I know you.
From the writer of Panic Room, Johnny Depp.
Leave me alone.
Secret Window, rated PG-13.
Man, I thought this. I thought time would have been a little kinder to this movie. I'm like, let's check. This movie sucks.
Okay, twist endings are such hit and miss. It's really subjective. But a bad twist ending can just make you pissed off. I watched this with my awesome roommate, Karen, and she was riveted the entire film. She was just like, oh my gosh, what is going on? And then the ending started to come in board, and she was like, wait a minute. Is this
shooter? No. Shooter? Shoot!
Come on, shoot her!
Damn you, movie!
Damn you, me!
Me for watching it with her. She was like actively angry at me for having wasted that time just based on the last 5 minutes. Because before then, she was having a great time, but the last 5 minutes ruined the experience for her.
So for us. Group of 20, like, let's say somewhere between 6 and 12, 20-year-old guys, finally living alone, doing what we want, playing video games, arm wrestling, watching The Sopranos, getting drunk, smoking cigarettes. This movie commercial played every 7 seconds, and John Turturro at the end of every one said, I will burn your life. We said that to each other. Like, it just became so part of our vernacular. I remember playing Street Fighter and Elbow, like, I'm burning your life. I will burn your life, dude. I will fucking burn your life. We built it up Snakes on a Plane style. We're like, this movie's going to be awesome. And it was. And we finally saw it and never said it again. For months, we threatened to burn one another's life, thanks to John Turturro, in this ridiculous character. One of the more unconvincing, ridiculous characters John Turturro has ever done, because he's amazing.
There are things to like about this, except I called the twist, and that made it even worse the whole time. Like, well you better surprise me at the end, because that's what I think's happening, because it's about a writer and he's splitting it up from his wife.
Wait, a story about a writer who ends up writing his own horror story by Stephen King? Are you sure?
I know, and he lives out in the woods.
Are you sure?
Whoa. So
Stephen King said that this was the last time he was ever going to have a writer be a protagonist. And liar, sir, why must you turn your house into a house of lies?
It was great, because I knew this was a mystery writer living out in the woods. I guessed it was Stephen King without looking it up, and I was right. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, then this weird, creepy John Turturro shows up and goes, "You stole my story." And is like, "You stole a story that I wrote." And Johnny Depp is like, no, I didn't. Mine was published first, I swear. And then John Turturro goes around ruining his life and like setting his house on fire and being creepy and framing him for stuff. And what could the twist possibly be?
Meanwhile, he has writer's block and can't get anything on. Oh, boy.
Gosh. Kind of like that all work and no play makes something, something, something.
Yeah. Hey, it's him. Go there. Crazy. I don't care if I want to spoil this. I don't want anybody watching this.
Yeah.
No.
We are doing you a favor, listener. If you were hearing our description and you were like, "I'm going to go see it," do not.
And just also, like, I feel like Johnny Depp spent most of his career making calculated and careful choices. This is one of the least careful, least, like, what were you going to bring to this? Other than, like, do I have to cut my hair? No, Johnny, you don't have to cut your hair.
This is definitely filmed before Pirates was such a big hit.
Really?
You know, so he's in, if you look at the timeline, it's got to be.
Okay.
You don't turn over a movie that quickly.
Mm. Yeah. And it's a bummer because it's written and directed by David Koepp, who's generally a really good screenwriter.
You're going to Jurassic
Park. Yeah, Jurassic Park and Spider-Man and Carlito's Way, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
But, you know, this ain't it.
Ba-ba-ba-boo. Boo.
It could be worse. I think that was sort of my impression as I was watching. I was like, well, this is like competently made and acted, and but the story's just dumb. So... Mm.
So your appraisal of this is everyone who's dated me.
Yeah.
It could be worse. And then a bunch of TV I did not see at all premieres this week.
I don't know most of these.
Cracking up. God, that sounds funny.
A psychologist student goes to live with a wealthy, eccentric Beverly Hills family.
What? Is it Family of Eggs? Oh. Family of Eggs. No.
That's created by Mike White, though.
Hey, all right. Why did I keep shitting on Mike White? Hey. Game over.
Video game characters when they're off duty living a suburban life.
I remember this. Did you love Drawn Together? Game over, baby.
Ugh. Except, this will make your ears bleed in the current year. The CGI graphics that UPN could deliver to you in 2004.
I remember Touching Evil is out this week.
Oh, is this the American one? I guess
the American version of the British show.
Right.
Touching Evil. I did see this week, the detectives obtained those pictures of R. Kelly having sex with that underage girl illegally, so we cannot use them against him. Like, our legal system is fucking crazy. Crazy. That's my Touching Evil this week. And Wonder Falls is the only show I feel guilty for not having seen, because that has quite a cult fan base behind it.
Yeah, this is almost the theme of the episode of shows that I've been told so many times to watch, and I'm gonna love them, and I believe you, and I haven't gotten to it.
Well, it was 2004, and your way to discover these, this show's great, you should watch it. That's a $60 DVD for something I haven't seen and was canceled. Until Netflix came along, it was kind of difficult to ride on that train, unless you're pirating, which I was, so I don't know why I didn't do it. But what's the pitch on Wonderful?
It's about a Niagara Falls gift shop. Someone who works in a dead-end job there, and animal figures talk to them.
Oh.
And that tells them to help people in need. It's co-created by Brian Fuller, mm-hmm. who is always someone who gets my attention, you know, whether it's Hannibal or Dead Like Me. So, this has been so far at the top of my list for so long. There's only 13 episodes. I should just fucking watch it, goddammit. And I haven't, and I'm sorry.
Love talking about a show that I'm watching currently. R.I.P. Richard Lewis. Curb Your Enthusiasm is back for the last time and fucking great. I've never heard more people shit on the show than this year, but like, I love it still. And season 4 was kind of like when it solidified, like, I hope this is around forever. What a great
chef's
thing.
Kiss all around. I can't believe that I did not see what was coming at the end of season 4 of Curb Your Enthusiasm, because this is the season about how Mel Brooks is insisting that Larry David needs to star in the LA production of The Producers with David Schwimmer. and it's just this whole time, he's like, I mean, Mel believes in me. I should probably do it. And he's pissing everyone off and he's being Larry David. And then the finale finally pays it off. The producer's plot was a producer's plot.
Yes.
The whole idea was that Mel Brooks wanted to destroy the musical, the producers, so it would stop dominating his life. And Anne Bancroft is there too, RIP, and to her just sitting there so depressed, like, no way out, no way out, no way out, which is from the original movie. Look, the original producers is one of my top five favorite movies. And this absolutely destroyed me. I was like, oh my, I can't believe that they're just doing the thing. And how did I not see it coming? And then it does become the producers because Larry figures out a way to make it better. He Larrys it so hard that he fails until he succeeds. And now they're trapped dealing with the producers forever.
There's so many things I like about this. One of the things that has since been undone, Larry David, famous for being the co-creator of Seinfeld, and Jerry Seinfeld has yet to make an appearance on Curb Your Enthusiasm. He keeps, I might do it at some point, and like, how about this? I'll do it in the fourth season. And it gives you the wonderfully lackluster, it's just Jerry Seinfeld reacting poorly in the audience of the producers. That's all you get for the grand Seinfeld reunion. They since have blah, blah, blah. And I hate that I know how this season of Curb Your Enthusiasm is going to end, God damn it. But it will be Seinfeldian very, very much. I know where it's going, God damn it.
So Diana raved about this episode to me, so I watched it, and I've only seen one or two other episodes of Curb in my entire life. Really? And I got to say, even going in with almost nothing, this works. This is a solid standalone episode. It made me want to watch like a lot of Curb, like a lot.
And yep. Does this have Stephen Colbert in it?
Me?
I think he's in here he's in the season somewhere, but he's not playing himself. But I'm like, this dude is too big to not play himself. You will fail, Larry. He gives him that. You will fail, does a hand gesture at him. JR, I love seeing people. The great thing about Curb is that people keep rediscovering it. My uncle, he's like, I can't believe I never heard about this. Like, me neither, but I'm glad you're binging 12 seasons of 20-year-old Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes. Holy shit. It's great. And then moving into it, even recommended by JR as a Curb virgin. Curgeon?
Yep.
Yeah.
Curgeon.
Curgeon. And wow, holy shit. Video Games of 20 Years Ago, March 8th through the 4th, 2004. Firefighter FD-18 for PS2.
Ooh. This was made by a bunch of Japanese salarymen whose only knowledge of American firefighters has come from watching Ron Howard's Backdraft one too many times. I mean, there's a certain type of media where it's set in another country, but made by a different country. And it's this weird funhouse mirror version of that country.
Yes.
And I feel like that's becoming less and less common, but it's on full display here.
Yeah. Well, Japan, especially because they made their products did so well in the West. We have to try and West this up a bit. Sort of speaking of a little bit at the opposite, something very Japanese remade by Americans, Metal Gear Solid, the Twin Snakes for GameCube. This never happens to me. Garage sale a few months ago. See a pristine copy of this, $2. This game is worth $150 to $300 in that the condition I found it in. So wow. I obviously have not taken it out of its case. But a Nintendo-fication of the PlayStation 1's Metal Gear. That's a pretty old game at this point. But it's given better graphics and Nintendo characters and things appear in this. It's never been available in any other way. And it's quite a sought-after. Maybe even a definitive version of Metal Gear. I don't know. I haven't actually played it myself. But is that about cover it, JR? Anything else on Twin Snakes?
Never played it.
And well, please chime in with the next game, Seven Samurai 20XX.
What?
All right. This is based upon Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai.
Oh, and no.
You know what we really have to do? We have to set it in the future. And Diana?
Yeah?
Do you remember that scene from Seven Samurai where the two roller skating brothers appear to drop some quick burns on the Seven Samurai? Do you remember that scene?
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah, the roasting scene? Oh, I loved it.
Yeah, and okay. But there is actually a really moving scene in Seven Samurai where they go to save the baby, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And this is that scene turned into a cheesy video game cutscene.
Mind if I step a little closer?
I said get back!
Okay, no problem.
Could you see the baby? Does he have it?
Yes.
What the fuck? And then lastly, something I played.
Wait, hold on a second. So as I understand it, this is like a hack and slash game, but the character designs are by Mobius and the music is Ryuichi Sakamoto? That's some classy that's right. shit to be putting into future samurai slash, which hack and slash is not the point of the movie.
The game everyone.
I guarantee you what they did is they went, our game's garbage. Let's throw some money at some talent so people don't realize how much we're pissing on Akira Kurosawa's graves.
And then a near and dear game to me, just because JR, were you into PC multiplayer games around this time?
No, I didn't get into them until Friday the 13th.
Well, do you remember from about 20 years ago, I'm sure where you lived, there was a lot of upstart companies that were creating gaming cafes is because of games like Battlefield and Battlefield Vietnam, kind of sold as a sequel to Battlefield, but it is very much an expansion. It is very much a Vietnam version of World War II. As if Creedence Clearwater Revival's Fortunate Son was not already synonymous with shipping off to Vietnam, that was this game's loading song. When it let me double click. Battlefield Vietnam is out. I played a shitload of it. In hindsight, I don't know why. I don't think it was very good, but it was new Battlefield for the first time, and it was exciting. Back when I still PC gamed, they opened up a gaming cafe and started a weekly tournament for Battlefield Vietnam. It was called Juggernauts, and they hired women to dress scantily clad and called them Juggernauties. Yes.
Aww.
Yes. This happened. This happened, but not very successfully and for very long. But thank you, Battlefield. And then something JR was posting about one of the most fascinating. I've never finished this series.
Has anyone?
I don't know. But it is really beautiful to look upon and fascinating to read about. Dave Sims' Cerberus, the Aardvark. This, after 27 years of continuous publication, because it's just him, right? Like, there's not even anybody coloring
this. Yeah, just him. He holds the North American. He's beaten by a bunch of Japanese guys, but he holds the North American record for longest comic made by one person. So he did all the writing. He did all the drawing, except for a little few backgrounds here and there. He did the lettering, which is gorgeous. 27 years. As a 23-year-old, this man decided, I'm going to make 300 issues of a continuous story and followed through. That's one of the most impressive stories in all of indie comics.
Because I don't even know what the money was like for him. I mean, I have to imagine, given the nature of having no employees, he could make a living. But, like, was this successful? Because, like, I've been in and out of comics obsession at least 5 times in my life. Someone will always mention Dave Sim Cerberus because it is insane. How do you nutshell?
This is when I have seen the published volumes, and everyone is. I even saw. Oh, they're called the phone books because each one is the size of a phone book, and there are a lot of them. It's not like there's just one big collection. No, that's a lot.
Have you read them all, JR?
No, this is my white whale. I was really into comics when this was being published. And I was like, I'll get around to it later. I'm spending all my money on Marvel and Sandman. I'm not going to go into this. And then time passed and time passed. And I think enough time has passed that I'll never get around to it just because I think I've moved on. Mm-hmm. The medium's moved on. So, yeah, sometimes there's media you can only really enjoy at a certain point in your life. And I do not think I'm in the phase of my life where I would enjoy reading this.
Because I have never read any of it. I've seen, some panels, and I think the artwork's gorgeous. That it starts as sort of like a Conan story, but I understand it to be very dense. on.
That's I've read the first volume. That was a Conan story.
Plot, philosophy, and also I've heard he fucking hates women.
Yeah, you know, there's one storyline where the main character leads a rebellion against uppity women. And he executes the unpretty women, but if the women are pretty, he puts them in a garden until they're old and no longer pretty and then can be safely executed.
Oh,
and
running theme this
week. He pointed out that he wants you, if you want to work with him, you have to sign a document stating that you do not believe he's misogynistic.
Mm.
You know.
Great guy.
That's a normal thing to do. Yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah, because I remember, like, I got handed the first volume. I'm reading it, and like, man, I'm just not into like barbarian shit. And like, this is not a barbarian story. Like, well, it is now. Like, trust me, it goes off the wall eventually, and it does over the course of 30 years.
Dave Sim has mental problems, and many readers try to read the comic and be like, here is when his schizophrenia really kicked in. Other readers read it and say, here is where he became a bitter divorced man and went off the rails. Hmm. You know, whether his problems are psychiatric, mental illness, psychological, just being an asshole, it's actually kind of a deep question. It's kind of a hard, complex question to answer.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I'm going to break this one up at this point. But Cerberus, it was fascinating to look upon and a fantastic little story of independent outsider art. We're going to close out with some fucking wigwam. Start dancing, yeah. John Cena, because, new wigwam convert over here. But I turn to you off of their album 667, The Neighbor of the Beast. Still making me giggle for some reason. Close out some wigwam, but don't go anywhere. One more segment, and we'll be all through this week.
I turn to you like a flower leaning toward the sun. I turn to you because you're the only one who can turn me around when I'm upside down.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. Internet and all the ships at sea. It's time for Diana's Classic Corner. We go even further back in time this week to see if there's anything worth a watching. And for the week of March 8th through 14th, we got something. It's all over the place. All right, let's start with 40 years ago. This week saw the release of Splash. We talked about R.I.P. John Candy last week. This was a big breakout role for him. He steals every frame that he is in, but also big important early role for Tom Hanks, made him sort of bankable, and Ron Howard as a director. It's weird that this is like the origin story for everyone of just making the Goofy Mermaid movie, but they do it so well. Like, no one's made a good mermaid movie since then. I haven't seen the Teenage Kraken movie. I've heard it's pretty good, but it's not the same. Also, from 1984, this week saw the release of Nausicaä, Valley of the Wind, which is Hayao Miyazaki's second movie. This one's based on his own manga. I still have not seen a Miyazaki movie that I didn't like, and I fucking hate manga and anime. I really do. I'm allergic. I don't know why. I haven't watched this one yet. I've heard nothing but wonderful things. It looks gorgeous just looking at clips of it. So, okay. Yeah, Michael's going to be so happy. He's going to get to show me this one. I'll watch it. It's the things I do for you, people. I love you. Then a really goofy recommend, one of those movies that just like popped up on TCM and I'm like, I've never heard of this. And then I watched it, I'm like, what the crap did I just watch? From 1964, it's What a Way to Go! Exclamation point. Starring two folks we just talked about in 1994, Shirley MacLaine and Paul Newman. And also Dean Martin, Gene Kelly, Dick Van Dyke, Robert Mitchum. It is the weirdest, silliest movie about this woman. It's a kind of movie we don't make anymore, which is sort of like the all-star. It's almost a sketch movie with a ton of stars, where it's about like Shirley MacLaine and she's looking for love, and she, you know, marries this guy and he's a bohemian painter, and then he gets all weird and then she's got to leave him, and then she marries this guy and he's an up-and-coming star, and then he goes insane and then she's got to leave him. And the sequence with Gene Kelly, where his character is like an actor named Pinky and he becomes obsessed with pink, is like his signature thing. And there's some scenes where they live in a pink house with a pink pool and pink furniture. Everything has been colored the same color pink. Kind of expected how Barbie would end up looking, but no, it is so strange to look at. You really should see it. What a Way to Go is just a very goofy 60s rom-com that I quite enjoy, even though I can't say it's like good. It's just different, man. And then 7 years ago this week, wrapping it up, from 1954, is a movie called Salt of the Earth, which was a independent drama written by blacklisted people from Hollywood, because it's all about like a strike in Mexico, or New Mexico, but a lot of Latino workers and stuff. And it's just really, really well done. Like, it covers a lot of labor issues in an interesting and entertaining way that, like, kind of like Schindler's List, is a movie you expect is going to be vegetables, and it ends up being really enjoyable. So Salt of the Earth, 1954. I think it's not that hard to find, because I think it might be public domain now, because a lot of independent movies had issues with that. And then finally, I figured, okay, what should I recommend to go with Schindler's List as Holocaust movies? And it's like, all right, the gold standard is Shoah, which is a documentary that is 9 hours long. Now, if you don't want to do that, and I don't blame you, I have still never finished Shoah. There's also, a couple years ago, Ken Burns made a documentary called The U.S. and the Holocaust. That's 6 hours, 3 2-hour parts. I'll recommend the first one in particular, because it kind of sets the stage pre-war of what was going on in America, what was going on in Germany, and what our immigration policies were like. In a way, if you have to watch a part, you should just probably watch the first part. It's probably available on your PBS station, you know, through their app or whatever. And then more recent movies, I mentioned Zone of Interest. But yeah, I kind of want to talk about movies that look at it from a different point of view. So Zone of Interest from 2023 is very interesting. Son of Saul, which is a Hungarian film, looks at it from a completely different point of view, but it is on the ground at a camp, and it's really, really good. Same with Ida from Poland from a couple years ago. I think those both won Best Foreign Language Oscars, because they both come at a difficult subject we kind of feel has been covered, telling the story from an angle and getting us into the truths of, you know, man's inhumanity to man, but in a different personal way. So I recommend those. Yeah, I know you should probably watch Shoah, but God, it's so long. And you know what? I'm gonna make myself do that. Next Yom HaShoah or Holocaust Remembrance Day, I'll take the week and I'll do like an hour at a time and finally get through Shoah. But that's it for this week. Hey, love not hate, everybody. Something about your body says, come and take me. Got me needed, baby girl. Got me begging, got me hoping that the night don't stop. Rock that body, cover, don't stop. Bailando, bailando.
Coming into 2014 with Bailando by Enrique Iglesias featuring Sean Paul, Decimer Bueno, hope I'm saying that right, and Gente de Zona off of Sex and Love. Is this a sequel to Bailamos?
That's kind of what I was thinking. Mm-hmm. The video is a lot of fun, but it did crack me up. I was like, wait, am I thinking of Bailamos? What is this song? And I click on it, and the second Sean Paul starts talking, I'm like, oh, okay, no, we're in 2014. Okay.
Well, welcome to 2014. Courtesy of Enrique. Other new music releases include A Perfect Contradiction by Paloma Faith, Stereolithic by 311, Going to Hell by Pretty Reckless, Supermodel by Foster the People, Kiss Me Once by Kylie Minogue, Recess, the debut of Skrillex. Man, 10 years is really creeping up. Young Money, Rise of an Empire by Young Money Entertainment, The Takeoff and Landing and Everything by Elbow, and Happy by Pharrell is still number one. This is, I don't know why this is so hard to believe, this is 10 years ago. The Malaysian Flight 370 from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. It disappears. That does not feel that feels very recent, but it is 10 years ago, presumably killing all 239 on board. No, they're fine in Atlantis, somewhere in the Bermuda Triangle. And
we still don't know.
Yeah.
Do you know how weird it is in 2014 and all the way to 2024 to have an entire airline just disappear?
Yeah.
We haven't found wreckage. We haven't found any definitive evidence. If you want your sci-fi story plane, this is it. No one can challenge you on it.
The whole thing is so strange. Like, they take off, and about half an hour in, they lose radio contact, but it's still on radar and satellites. And then it, like, turns the wrong way and goes for a while, and then it disappears. Yeah. But it's like, We're not out in the middle of the Pacific here. Like, we're in between Malaysia and the Philippines. That's a pretty trafficked area.
Yeah.
But then it turned, like, the wrong way. But they don't know. And, like, a little bit of wreckage a couple years later showed up, and they're not sure if it's real, if it's Malaysia Airlines. It's just something?
Yes, it's 10 years ago, but we're in an era of satellite technology, unprecedented satellite technology. It is still insane.
And it's gone. Whoosh.
I mean, the satellites do have to be aiming at the right time.
But you just figure some kind of triangulation or some such that would turn up some debris, a body. Like, we're all...
Right.
2014, we're tired of playing with Google Maps at this point. That's how accessible satellite technology is.
Yeah, you'd think that there would be... I mean, if it crashed, it should have broken open, and something that floats would eventually show up. Something.
Which, yes.
No, nothing.
I haven't been bored enough to look at my house on satellite, and I did recently to see if I could see my big skeleton for Halloween, and I did. But I also noticed my driveway is filthy, and I couldn't tell until I saw it from space. must be pressure washed. 2014 movies. Get ready. It's going to knock your socks off. Maybe. Perhaps with Jane Fonda, Ray Liotta, Ken Howard, Ben Schwartz, Michelle Monaghan, Olivia Wilde, Sam Rockwell, and Better Living Through Chemistry. I don't know.
This was a surprise for me.
Really?
Yeah.
I watched it. I was really surprised how much I enjoyed a movie about how much better this guy's life became after he started illegally taking drugs. Like, every aspect of his life improves. His job improves. His self-esteem improves. His relationship with his son improves. And he gets to a healthy spot emotionally that he can go with forward with a divorce. All through illegally taking drugs. The title is not a lie.
Yeah. It's such like a famous title, but this isn't adapted from anything. Better Living Through Chemistry. It just seems like...
Yeah. A small town pharmacist starts eating from his own supply and everything becomes better and he suffers no negative consequences from it.
And
I couldn't get to this because it was one of those where it's like, it's small, it's independent, it's barely released. But just the cast intrigued me to get Jane Fonda and Ray Liotta to show up in the same place with Olivia Wilde and Sam Rockwell.
There
like,
aren't enough movies starring Sam Rockwell. And the next movie, I didn't feel like I could do it a service because it's kind of a wonderful thing to have existed. It's one of the only Warner Brothers movies, I think, that was kickstarted and got a second shot at life without streaming. Enrico Colantoni, Tina Majorino. Wow, okay, just like
Tina Majorino.
So Chris Lowell. Percy Dexter, Francis Capra, Ryan Hansen, Kristen Ritter, Jason Doering, and of course Kristen Bell in Veronica Mars, the movie.
Local authorities have ruled the death a homicide and are focusing their investigation on her boyfriend, Logan Eccles.
I need your help, Veronica.
I don't really do that anymore.
What's this? I specifically told the agency an eager to please brunette.
Dick.
Hey, Logan, that girl who follows you around is here.
Oh, so yeah, I asked my lady friend who's a Veronica Mars fan, can I jump headlong into the Veronica Mars movie having not seen the series? And I was told kind of no. Like you.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have not seen a frame of the television show. Mm-hmm. I started watching this for about 20 minutes and I was just like, no, you clearly are demanding that I be familiar with all of this.
Yeah. It's...
So I had the same experience where this is like Wonder Falls, a show where literally everyone tells me how much I will love this show. And it has been on my list for, almost 20 years. But I was like, okay, I'm going to try this because this is a sequel. It takes place, years later. And I obviously wasn't getting everything out of it that I could because I didn't know who these characters were. But I still got enough, like the, murder mystery part. That was pretty good. I feel like I was missing out because I had no idea who the characters are or their history.
And that's the huge bummer about everything. It's a short-lived UPN-CW show, critically acclaimed, cult favorite, and all of a sudden this exciting new crowdfunding technology appears, and like, we can make more if the fans show up for it. And they did, but what you kind of want is a new season. Instead, like, kind of, I think Warner Brothers was willing to like match some of the backing, should it get that much financing to make a movie out of it. But it is, you know, kind of a season finale or like a one-off. And to really appreciate it, you're going to have to see the whole series.
Yeah. I was hoping it would be sort of like Firefly and Serenity, mm-hmm. where like they catch you up pretty fast in Serenity, that if you haven't watched Firefly, you could still enjoy the movie. This one, there's obviously, it's a much longer series and there's a lot more interpersonal stuff that it's like, I'm clearly missing the context, but that was a funny line.
It's so, 10 years after the high school detective, and there's a 10-year high school reunion. Like, you need to have seen the show for this reunion aspect to make the most sense. Yeah.
Also, being a high school detective has an expiration date, okay? If your whole shtick is I'm a teenage detective and you're approaching 30, that shtick doesn't work anymore.
No, you're not thinking of I'm a detective, but I'm also a PE coach. PE coach. Instead of teaching sex ed, I make my money being a detective.
But I still mostly enjoyed the movie. It mm-hmm. just felt like there's big gaps because I don't get everything. But according to people who have watched the show, the movie was pretty solid. Actually, got pretty good reviews, even from people like me who hadn't seen the show. They're like, yeah, I understand the appeal. Now I want to go watch the show.
I had the oddest experience with it. I'd read about it and like, this sounds great. And I put it on. And I remember my girlfriend walked in at the time, not my current, and got so fucking mad at me. This is how you're spending your time? It's one of the most unlike her things that's ever happened, that I was afraid to ever broach the subject of Veronica Mars again, because it like clicked something in her that made her incredibly angry at me. Must have been an odd day. I'm not really not trying to tell that story to shit on this person, but that's what happened, and I was never able to approach it, at least not in the years we were in a relationship together, because I don't know what she hated about Veronica Mars or Kristen Bell.
Dare you watch a show with a female protagonist?
Yeah.
The female protagonist.
It seems like something my shitty boyfriend would make fun of me about, but he was cool with it. And Veronica Mars, we're leaving that up to you, dear listener. You can shed some light on the Veronica Mars saga, because there was an eventual Hulu miniseries. It came back
in 2019 mm-hmm. for a short series.
It's also a little weird to me, like, a lot of people know Kristen Bell as Veronica Mars. I hadn't any exposure to it when I watched The Good Place. So to me, she's always her character from The Good Place. And anytime I like see her in something else, I'm like, nope.
She's always Anna to me and the president's daughter. And
yeah. do you get upset if she actually swears instead of saying forking fork?
Yeah, exactly.
She's not supposed to say that. Forking shirt balls. The Good Place is the best fucking show.
Yeah.
Oh, it's amazing.
And up next, Tyler Perry in a Tyler Perry movie. Zulay Hanau, Ryan Eggold, Wendy McClendon Covey. Got it. Reno 911 lady. William Levy, Terry Crews, Coco Brown, Amy Smart, Nia Long. It's the Single Moms Club.
On March 14th.
Wouldn't it be nice if we could all just help each other out?
One of us will watch the kids while the other four go out and have a good time.
Make it rain!
Call a sitter.
It's happening.
I like that.
Grab your girls.
We are hooking you up tonight.
Damn, you fine.
And join the club.
This is what the Single Moms Club is all about.
Tyler Perry's The Single Moms Club.
The most beautiful girl in the city.
Boy, please.
Rated PG.
Well, you won't be surprised. I have very little to say about this, having not watched it, because it is so specifically not in my wheelhouse. So very specifically.
I tried to give it a try. I really did. I mean, I've seen some Tyler Perry movies that I've liked, and I turned this on with the attitude of, you know, I think he gets a bad rap. And then it got to the point where the principal arrived, and she talks so not like a human. Like, just not like any human being I can picture talking in her position, that I was just like, no, you lost me.
But also the premise, isn't this what single moms do? That's what all the single moms I know do. Like, either they all bring the kids to one area and then they all get lightly drunk together. And
yeah, I didn't finish it. As one of these words, basically, I'm going to pick a moment in the middle and see if it grabs my attention. Because the reviews were pretty rough. It's like, yeah, but I want to give it a fair shake. And it's kind of like, I was, it seemed a little sappier than I was expecting. I was hoping for a little bit more empowerment as opposed to crying and hugging by the end. But that is kind of Tyler Perry's thing. So
then believe in Jesus. That's,
yeah, exactly. We can all get together at church later, I guess. Yeah, I don't know. I guess I was hoping for like a follow up to First Wives Club, but no.
Yeah, the title would lead you to believe that.
Yeah, but it's something, you know, a little bit more acidic like that. But it all works out in the end, you know. And I like so many of these people involved that, yeah, oh well.
The next up, as far as titles with expectations, of which I had none, and it delivered on those lack of expectations. Michael Keaton, Ramon Rodriguez, Imogene Poots, Scott Mascuti, Dominic Cooper, and Aaron Bitch Paul. It is the one video game franchise everybody was demanding be brought to the screen for all its famous characters and whatnot. Need for Speed.
Toby Marshall versus Dino Brewster. $7 million. Winner takes all. We'll settle this behind the wheel.
On March 14th.
Hold on!
From the director of Act of Valor.
Spread your wings, beauty!
Need for Speed. Rated PG-13.
Woo! Need for Speed. Oh, what is a less essential film than Need for Speed? I don't know where you are with this franchise, gaming franchise, JR. I lightly consider myself a Need for Speed fan in that I buy the games because they come out so frequently. A brand new game becomes like $20 in 8 months. And I've played most of them like that and for free for the latter 20 years of my life. I would never cry if the game series never released again, but I play about every one. The ones with named humans are the worst ones. Like, any game with a human in it is made fun of and mocked mercilessly by critics. Why? I get that the series has moved 150 million titles. It's together, that's near like Mario recognition. But it doesn't have any recognizable characters. None. None. And a reason to string the plot around it.
But what about Speed Need? You know, the main character, Speed Need.
Oh, he's addicted. It's quite sad. He goes through speed withdrawal. Now, I barely paid attention to the plot, and then, like, I'm just going to go on YouTube and see if car people have given a shit about these sequences, because it does make the interesting choice to, like, fuck CG. We're going to throw some cars around. We're going to do some interesting driving sequences.
Yeah. It's directed by a former stuntman, so that makes sense. Yeah.
But that's, they're practical and kind of bland. In that, like, this is coexisting with the Fast and the Furious series that's doing the same thing, but this is not only really grounded, it's shot on the exact same streets as Baby Driver and not shot the same way at all. It's way more subdued, one or two cars at a time, a lot less action happening. There is a really silly, fun sequence of gassing up a Mustang at 90 miles an hour with Mr. Robot Rami Malek hanging off of a car, throwing gas in another car. Kind of neat. It's just like, I if you don't know, for me, Baby Driver is a drunk lullaby film for me. I've seen it probably 20 times. You're filming a car movie on the exact same streets and it's not interesting? You can't do that. That's not going to hold my interest for very long. Need for Speed. I also, I think it marks, it's a pretty interesting milestone in how tentpole films are changing as of 10 years ago. We're now like, I grew up, movie franchises were bigger than any other franchise there was. They were bigger than books. They were bigger than TV. They're bigger than games. Not so 10 years ago. They had to start branching out and approaching other mediums to adapt. This movie costs $60 million, makes $300 million, and somehow failed to perform. Like, did not meet monetary expectations. Like, how do you do better than that? Holy shit, what are your marketing budgets looking like? Maybe pay attention to those.
I mean, it makes something like $300 million worldwide. That should be enough to get you a sequel that costs like half what this one does.
Exactly. Like, how does this fail? You're doing your job poorly. That's what's happening.
So I do wonder, because like the Grand Theft Auto people have said, we will never make a Grand Theft Auto movie because the risk to the brand is more damaging than any amount of money we could make from the movie. So maybe the Need for Speed people are like the same thing. This didn't set the world on fire. That's fine. We'll keep churning these suckers out. We don't need your dinky little movie money.
It also was a fun reminder that the Gran Turismo movie is about people playing Gran Turismo. Need for Speed. I don't know. I want to champion it, but it's like it's a scrappy little film with hundreds of millions of dollars behind it. Not terrible, not memorable. TV. Can we do TV?
Yeah.
TV.
Let's definitely do TV. Hey, did you know Aaron Paul was on a show called Breaking Bad? Did you know the creator of that show is on this episode of Community? They tied them together.
Such a fun episode. Nobody has taken the VCR board game to task in such a way than Community's VCR maintenance and educational publishing. Fucking fantastic. I don't know much about Harmontown, but I know the guest star is Spencer from Harmontown. I saw the documentary. I didn't listen to the show much, the Dan Harmon podcast. He was the listener who became the DM and big part of the show. And he's got a guest appearance as Annie's brother. And
And I thought you were going to talk about Paul Williams. Paul Williams shows up for no fucking reason. The guy who
Speaking
wrote
of Baby
all,
Driver.
All the best Muppet songs and also a lot of songs of his own. And Phantom of the Paradise.
Made a great ape in Planet of the Apes 5.
Yep. And it's just so random to show up as the guy who deals textbooks.
Yeah. And then they find a bunch of old textbooks and they're like, we can resell these. And instantly it becomes like selling drugs. But the hook for me was always the VCR game because I did play some of those in my youth and they were such garbage. They were horrible, monstrous games that should not exist. And I'm glad someone finally mocked them. Did either of you ever play one?
When I was really little, they were super.
There was a Star Wars one I played.
There's a Star Trek one with like the whole cast.
Oh my God.
they were, you don't want to call them popular, but they had like a 2-year ubiquity before. Because they're hard. They're not only hard to play, they require a lot of queuing, which VCRs are inherently not great at. And how do you play them more than once? Like, what is the replay value on these things?
Yeah, there was, what was the other one that I played? Played a bunch, and that basically acted as a timer where you would just play the game, and every now and then something would come up on the VCR and be like, stop, the person who's playing, you have to take a card that's this, or you have to go back 10 spaces or something. It's like, oh, okay, you don't have to do any queuing or anything. It really is just like, yeah, it's just a random timer that's changing the game slightly.
And of all Community's post-episode sequences, this might be my favorite. It's Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad, star of the board game throughout the episode, in a totally out there scene with him and his wife, who's somehow Gina Gershon, telling him it's right that you quit Apple and sell all your stock to invest everything into VCR board games. I believe in you, honey. I believe in you.
Besides all the VCR stuff, I think we're forgetting this episode opens with Dean Pelton's Finest Hour, which is the payday rap, where he raps about how everyone's checks are late while dressed like a giant candy bar, and then goes completely off the rails and give him all of the awards. Seriously. so much fun.
And then next up, the best show most people have not seen ever. Don't know if anything can reach the heights of recommendation of Schindler's List, but Andy Daly's review is up there. I never saw the original show, still haven't. A phenomenal, phenomenal program about a man, life, but is it any good? He reviews aspects of life, but has a journalistic integrity about it that ruins his life. So I thought this was just going to be a self-contained episodes of a comedy show. Instead, it's the arc that's fascinating. What does he do in this episode, the first episode?
So he reviews being a racist. He decides he is going to become a racist to give it a review.
My efforts were causing more confusion than oppression.
Wait, this one is the colored copier, isn't it that one?
This is the colored copier. That one is the color copier.
So this is the black and white copier?
That's the white copier.
Look, I just need to make a color copy.
Well, go ahead and do it. Just don't use the colored copier. The white copier is better anyway.
It makes colored copies.
I don't know why. It's it's the best thing Andy Daly has ever done. And I hope more people find it. And in the next segment, what's it like to be an addict? And so he decides, I will do drugs for the first time in my life. And
pain. When I get back from rehab, I'll probably say cocaine is terrible. But don't believe me. Cocaine is amazing. I give it a million stars.
Do not believe the guy in the studio who tries to tell you it's terrible. That guy is a liar.
No, I am not a liar. He is. I am a recovering addict who went to rehab and got clean. He is a drug-addled maniac who nearly destroyed his family and his financial security and his heart and his brain. Addiction, half a star.
And there's this big argument on the racism segment. Mm-hmm. Why are you giving it half a star? And it's like, well, we decided half a star was the lowest thing we were going to give. There can no be zero stars. Everything has to be a half a star. And they're like, yeah, but it's racism.
And but it's like we're introduced to his family and his child and his father-in-law. Everything he even tries divorce, even though he loves his wife dearly, decides to, I will give it a shot and divorce my wife. Ruins his life through the course of his commitment to this show. It's brilliant. It's three seasons of brilliance. I still love. What is having an affair like? Well, I can't cheat on my wife. I love her too. I'm going to order a life-size sex doll. And as matter of fact, coverage of it, like, I was having some problems moving Mona around the house. And there's no way I'm the most out of shape person to own one of these. And I'm struck. It's so. I love this show so much. I'm pretty sure it's on Paramount Plus. It's, again, one of the few shows like. But I bought this, all of it, on my Amazon account. I have like two shows on there, and this is one of them. So I can always revisit it. Review rules. And you should totally watch it. I'm guessing no one knows. It's based on an Australian show.
Yeah.
And it was never a ratings darling, but it was written about very well in a time when Comedy Central, we probably should start streaming this. And the internet's saying it's really great, but the TV ratings aren't showing that. But they gave it one of those, what do you call it, like a courtesy last season. Like, this did not do well enough, but we need to close the story out. So it is a complete loop, a complete story for review. Great show. Can't say anything about the show Sirens because I don't know it, but it premieres.
So it's about ambulance drivers. And on the very first episode, they have a man who, with his dying breath, asked them to erase his browser history.
So what do you guys think it is? Like some surprise birthday thing for the wife? Or, oh my God, you think he's having an affair?
Yeah, with online porn.
Really?
It's always about porn, Bri. Why else would a guy who's on his deathbed ask three strangers to go to his house and erase his computer history?
Maybe he's a terrorist. Oh my God, what if it's some kind of terrorist plot?
Right,
maybe
absolutely.
We should call the FBI or the NSA.
Do you know what the NSA considers the first significant sign that you're part of a terrorist plot?
What?
If you don't have porn on your computer.
Hello.
Oh, and then, man, see, about this show, bringing you back to a place in time. 10 years ago, I got my marijuana card. I smoked a lot of pot in high school, little in college, and then abandoned it largely as I discovered better drugs and had easier access to alcohol. Got my marijuana card to enhance solely my television viewing. One of the best things I ever got high to, Cosmos, A Space-Time Odyssey. So much fun to watch high. It's hard to even describe. I have vague memories of watching the original Cosmos with Carl Sagan. It's rebooted by Seth MacFarlane. I don't know how those two came together, but I think he remembered, had a fondness for the show that I remember. Did you see the original Cosmos, JR?
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah. The original Cosmos was a little too dense for baby JR.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I rented a few episodes on VHS.
It had one of the healthiest home video lives of anything from that era of my childhood, as far as TV goes. And this is equally great. Like, very weirdly connected vignettes about how the fucking universe works. Very well produced and well done. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, great host, as far as I'm concerned.
I thought he did a really good job.
Me too. It's like, I don't know what else to compare it to, but it's my favorite thing he's ever done. It's why no matter what shit I see people give him online, like, Cosmos was rad. I had a great time with that show.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's tough to, I mean, I'd say it's tough to like make the universe cool because it's like so incomprehensible, so much of the science stuff. And yeah, I love pop science stuff like this where it's like, okay, I'm an expert, but I'm going to talk to you like you're not an idiot, mm-hmm. but this is hard to understand. So let me demonstrate and we'll have graphics and we'll like explain it in the larger sense. And yeah, and just like, oh, okay.
Or I'll
meet superclusters. I love superclusters.
Beautifully animated cartoon to illustrate artificial selection, how dogs chose us to evolve with.
Like, okay. Yep. No, I watched all this. I freaking loved it.
Yeah, and just like, let's not overshadow a network primetime budget on a show about science. Yeah. Jesus Christ, if you think you hate Seth MacFarlane, this only happened because of him. Like, good Lord. Mm-hmm. I hope we see that again mm-hmm. in our lifetime.
The first Cosmos back in the day, you know, really inspired a lot of kids to get into, you know, astronomy and physics. And I hope that's true of this. You know, these kids who might have watched this 10 years ago might be heading to college now. And I hope they got interested because, yeah, astronomy was like the one science in college that I was like, this is amazing.
Wow. And up next, Lindsay premieres. Is this a reality show?
This is a reality TV show about Lindsay Lohan, and I never had an opinion on Lindsay Lohan. I just wasn't really into her when she was at her height of fame. I didn't really follow her descent. But watching 5 minutes of a clip of her on YouTube from this show makes me hate her. Just like, wow, I do not like you. I do not want good things to happen to you.
I blame her parents. They both sound like they're the worst people in the world. Yeah. I think most of the clips I've seen of them being horrible are probably from this show. So
I could believe it.
Right. Yeah. That's too bad. Yeah. I hate shows that are about people who are in the tabloids as everything falling apart. And then there's a reality show. We watch them supposedly put the shit together. And then no.
I mean, it's hard to not.
They don't.
You're filming this person at their worst.
Exactly. And I don't need to see this. Just stop it.
Yeah. And the next show I tried with, couldn't get into it. From Dusk Till Dawn, the series premieres. What I want to talk more about, because we never did get to mention it, that what it premiered on, the El Rey Network. And I've long since abandoned over-the-air television, but I think this channel has too. But a weird deal with Comcast and Univision and get Robert Rodriguez to program a whole channel. And what that meant, did you ever watch this channel? I was fascinated by it. Because
very occasionally I would be looking at the TV listings and be like, what the hell? Oh, okay, it's on El Rey.
They would have bumpers in like, one, they play like Kung Fu films, obscure Kung Fu films, Godzilla movies, and we're talking like 10 years ago on regular TV, and they would say, everything here has been edited for television. After 8 o'clock, everything will be presented again, unedited. So you'd get your sanitized cable version of something, and they'd like, later on, all the blood and the tits are going back in, and you can watch that version. And yeah, like, I think there are a few dreams I've had other than, like, I would love to program a goddamn channel of stuff that I like. And Robert Rodriguez got to do that, and I just happen to like a lot of the things that he likes. Except the show based on his movie, which I did not like. Young, pretty people taking over for Tarantino and George Clooney. It's telling the same story of the first film very elongatedly. With a lesser budget. Wasn't for me, but I don't know that it's... I can't tell you whether or not it's terrible. It just lost my interest, and I was very much there for it. And then lastly, True Detective episode, Form and Void. Is this the end?
Yeah, this is where we get the King in Yellow, which to me is just where this series becomes amazing. Just like, you stuck the landing, and that is so hard to do in an anthology show like this is. But it did it. It really just nailed it perfectly.
Yeah, on the conclusion of the fourth season, which I very much enjoyed, I watched everyone with my lady, and like, it's very hard to describe this series and the plot of the series. And she's just like, yeah, it's really more of a vibe. I'm like, that's exactly what True Detective is. It's a really dark, menacing vibe, and it kind of doesn't matter where you end up. It's about being locked inside of it and confused. That's the most fun part about True Detective. Love our True Detective. And I'm really glad it came back for a fourth season because it was so much fun. And I hope to see more of it. Oh, video games of 2014. JR, you didn't even notice. On Video Game Apocalypse, Mr. Diana Goodman, Michael Raparez, tried to make us debate over the best edition, the best middle editions of popular trilogy.
Nice.
One of the things that made the list is Dark Souls 2, 10 years old this week. 10 years old this week. Brendan of The Crawl championed it very hard, as Matt was there for it as well. It's the Dark Souls I've had the least amount of time with, so I can't speak to much of that. So listen to Vigigame Apocalypse if you want to hear a bunch of people go to bat for Dark Souls 2. Kind of, from what I remember Brendan saying, it's where it starts dabbling with the open world that will become Elden Ring, From's best-selling game of all time. Oh man, I remember this taking hold of everybody. Hearthstone, Heroes of Warcraft, or as I called it back then to make fun of my friends, Call of Duty Poker, is out. The most popular card games that I've ever, like, because I was working on Street Fighter, and everybody who ate, slept, and breathed Street Fighter could not stop getting involved in Hearthstone. It was like that kind of, but it's a fucking card game. And I was just like, it's Blizzard, spend the money. Don't make a card game. But it was hugely, hugely popular for a while, Hearthstone. And then a game I spent a ton of time with, Titanfall. Titanfall is 10 years old. The little franchise that couldn't, actually, that's not true. I think it's Apex Legend is part of the Titanfall universe. And that's currently a very popular free-to-play online shooter from Respawn. But it's the Call of Duty people leaving Call of Duty, and the first game they made under their EA contract was a shooter, but oh yeah, you also have a mech you can fire yourself into and out of the center of its belly. It's very, very, very cool, and I was momentarily obsessed with it. It was maligned for having no campaign, something Call of Duty games were famous for. Instead, this had like dialogue in multiplayer maps populated by bots. That was its equivalent of a campaign. I can understand how that was lackluster, but the online was great. I remember my buddy Chris Waters calling it an awesome moment simulator. Your mech is under heavy fire, about to die. You just eject the fuck out of that thing and wall run up a building and fire your grenade weapon at the guy who took you down. It was really cool. And Titanfall 2 improved on that even more. I think they're all available via Game Pass if you're a Game Pass subscriber, given their thing with EA. And Titanfall 2 is even better. But Titanfall was pretty wonderful, and I wish more people would have embraced it. But here we are. Towerfall Ascension, I don't have a ton of time with. But
these words are conflicting to me.
I can see why. I can see why. I'm going to guess a tower defense game. This is me shrugging. I feel like I saw it. But I was too busy playing Yoshi's New Island, one of the Why Now sequels to Yoshi's Island, an equally weird sequel to Super Mario World.
So many of those from the Big N. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't Yoshi's Island always the thing? It was popular. It was a hit. Fans loved it. Why just be like, well, once every 20 years is enough?
Yeah, I think the only thing I can imagine in like 06, they did a really great re-release of Yoshi's Island on the DS. And maybe more people found the series that way. But this is not developed by Nintendo. It's developed by another studio. And is, according to reviews, pretty derivative. And enters some new territory at the end of the game where it could have been used. Those ideas would have been better served early and throughout the game.
I had an ex-girlfriend who Yoshi's Island was her meditative thing. She would just play that game. And she played like no other game other than that. And so she just knew it backwards and forwards, and she just did it to be like calming down or whatever.
Speaking of a vibe, like a very pleasant aesthetic game, aesthetically pleasant game. And I didn't play like that. I played it hardcore. It makes me feel so old. We had one cartridge between three friends, and we would look at each other's save file and try and beat their time and score and how many, because you'd get like a 1 through 100 score on your levels, and we'd pass the cart back and forth. Your turn, bitch, go. I got 100 on this. Better get all them flowers. But Yoshi's New Island, I haven't heard anybody talk about it in 10 years, but there was technically another sequel to that in addition to the N64 one. And that's about it for the show. We're going to tell you who died during this period of 302010 and do a fun little quiz you can play along with. A little bit of plugs. Let's get out of here. Patreon.com/LaserTime makes all this possible. JR got a new episode. What is it? What do we got there? 80s in Depth.
Blinking.
Repo Man. Repo Man. And
yeah.
And by the time you hear this, we will have a brand spanking new episode of 80s in Depth covering one of the classics, Escape from New York.
I'm all about the Duke. Duke is the best. I want that car.
Love that shit. And Di, where can folks find you at?
They can find me on the Blue Sky, because we talked about Twitter, at ListenANerd, LecineNerd, where you can find all of the things that we recommended this week. To double check, JR, are you recommending Better Living Through Chemistry?
I am definitely recommending it. It's a solid watch.
Okay. So coming up next week, well, we already mentioned the end of a trilogy going 33 and a third. Oh, boy. I remember one thing about it, and yeah, it's the same thing that Ace Ventura had. But we have, let's see, the debut of Zack Snyder in a remake I hear is quite good. I have not watched yet, but I definitely will. We have the first actual 100% classic of the fours, of 94, 04, and 14, a movie that, JR, I have to give you so much credit for describing it as When Harry Forgot Sally. That is so perfect. Yeah. I love that. Like I said, Ace Ventura, here's my favorite Jim Carrey movie.
You got to quit dropping those bombs off mic, JR. I keep stealing, changing the name of Tiana's Bayou Adventure to Princess in the Log, the new Splash Mountain. It's such a great name. Princess in the Log.
Then also we have, Chris, you mentioned earlier that you don't like when kids' movies decide, let's go to Europe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's time to play the music. It's time to light the lights.
Yeah.
It's time for Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Volume 1.
Oh, God damn it. Wow. Never.
No, fuck that. The Muppets are getting arrested and sent to gulags next week.
I love that movie.
I love that movie, too.
And if that wasn't enough, we get to talk about the first Castlevania game to be on the Genesis. Robert Loggia gets sent back to jail on The Sopranos.
Oh, Feach.
Feach.
The best TV Western of all time makes its debut.
What?
Briscoe County's already on. I don't get it.
And could it be something for cocksuckers of all stripes and sizes?
Lots of cocksuckers. So many cocksuckers all over the place.
Can Hoopleheads come?
It's a television show that makes swearing a Shakespearean art form. Yeah. I swear to God.
Yeah.
And if that wasn't enough, finally, Community will play some Dungeons and Dragons.
Woo! Oh, man. Ooh. A band episode. Oh. Great.
Yep. No, it's not the band episode. It's the follow-up
episode. The band episode.
That one's been banned? No, the first one was banned because of blackface.
Okay.
Not really.
The second one, I know it's not really blackface, but... Oh, and also South Park's going anime, and Rick and Morty are going to show us Interdimensional Cable.
Wow. That all happens?
It's a good one. It's a good one. Yeah. I got ants in my eyes already.
All right. Not going to fight that love. That's a hell of a tease for next week to apologize for the Schindler's List listing this week. But whatever. If the moral of this episode, less Twitter, more Schindler's List. Diana, who died this week?
Oh, we only have one, but it is kind of a surprise. In 1994, we lost Charles Bukowski, who was 73. I don't think anyone thought he was making it to 73. He is a poet and short story writer. Barfly is based on him, who's kind of all about the grungy underside of everything. It's all about drinking and drugs and hating yourself and wanting to die and, you know, being homeless and hating everyone and the decay of modern life. I don't know how you
know, for kids.
That's it. That's the only one.
I wish I knew more about him. I don't know that I've read anything.
And I'm not sure that I have either. I maybe have.
And with the deaths comes the birthday quiz.
Oh, birthday is a doodly-doo, a ding-dong, doodly-doodly-ding-dong-doo.
Birthday.
Okay. Turning 30.
30.
A baby.
A baby.
Someone was born this week that we talked about.
Mm-hmm. I really hope you know his name because you have definitely seen him. I guarantee you've seen him in multiple major works. You just may not know his name. So we'll see. Okay? born March 14th, 1994, in New York City.
New York City.
His father was a fashion photographer for Vogue, and his mother was a opera director.
Ooh, fancy.
Okay, so he's born in the creative arts.
His father named him after a prominent nature photographer.
Jacques Cousteau. No. Diana's got it already.
Let me just continue. In April of 2020, he posted a nude photograph of himself on social media as part of a fundraising effort to feed those affected by COVID.
Interesting.
How does your
movies
dick do
of his
that?
We've talked about are only one. Carrie is the only movie of his we've talked about.
Oh, okay, because he's probably not.
But he starred in The Fault in Our Stars.
Yep.
And is a major supporting role in the Divergent series.
Which we're also about to talk about.
No fair.
About to, but haven't.
Nope. I think it's next week also. Yeah.
No fair picking a youngling star of young movies.
Oh, he stars in a movie you mentioned this episode.
Really?
He is the title character in Baby Driver.
Oh, Ansel Elgort? What's his name?
Yeah, Ansel Elgort.
Ansel Elgort? I've never said it out loud.
Named after Ansel Adams. Okay.
Yep. Oh, exactly.
Hey. That's where the crazy name comes from.
Thank you for the nature photographer. There's only a couple that I'm like,
I personally didn't recognize his name, but as soon as I looked him up, I was like, oh, I know this guy.
Yeah.
So I wanted to give you a little hint.
And minor shout out, I thought I was going to blow Michael and Diana's mind. Like, I just found Tokyo Vice. Holy shit. If you've ever been a Japanophile and a writer, what a fun show to watch. And it's like, I keep watching it like, I could maybe learn a different language. I could never learn a different language's word processor. No, I'm out. I am not using the Japanese Microsoft Word. It looks incredibly confusing. Whew.
And I should mention Ansel Elgort has been lately Me Too'd. I don't know what's happened with those allegations. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Not sure what happened. That's one of those where it's like it got lost amidst the COVID stuff because it was between the filming of West Side Story and it actually coming out. And everyone kind of went, what do we do? Nothing.
Never heard that. Well, he's going to go join his buddy Kevin Spacey and make Baby Driver 2.
Oh,
God damn it. All right. Happy birthday, Hansel, unless I shouldn't have said that. But that about wraps up the show. What's closing us out?
Closer.
Closer?
Is it not called Closer by Nine Inch Nails?
I always thought it was Closer, but he doesn't say either word in the song.
No, Downward Spiral came out 30 years ago this week, so I have to put it in there. Like, a song and a music video, especially by Mark Romanek, that like blew everyone's mind at the time. Like, you can do that? This is happening?
Yes.
Yeah, what is this?
Again, just such an odd, at the time, pop song. Like, holy shit.
And there's the radio edit, and you would hear it on the radio, and you'd be like, I know what that word is.
They really get that F in there.
Yeah. And also, again, going back to Magic Mike XXL, the only perfect film, they use this music cue so wonderfully in it, I laughed. Like, I missed the next 5 minutes. I was laughing so hard.
Hell yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Patreon.com/LaserTime. Take us out, Nine Inch Nails. We'll see you next week.